Well, we don't have anything to record yet, so I don't know if you have to do that.
Get them, but then.
Well, sounds like a plan.
All right, you're on.
Cool.
Get in here.
Hi, Miss Karen. How are you? Hi. Karen's voice microphone is off. Can you turn Karen's microphone on?
Yeah, hi.
There you go. Hi. Did you get the Judy Lefever sent me a note. I don't know if she copied you on that. That who? Gail Ferlin and her husband out of Canada donated $1,000 Canadian to the charity.
Wonderful.
And it comes out to $750. It was 25%, you know, with the Canadian dollar. So it came out to $750 into the charity, and they were, I think, asking for a letter for taxes or a thank you letter or something like that. So if we could email that to Gail, I can send you her email address or something like that.
I think I have it.
Okay, cool.
I'll do that.
Yeah, because they're sweet. And I forgot how much I put, $1,000, $2,000. I put something in around tax time also.
Okay.
So I think we're over 5,000 in the account right now.
Awesome. So
we're growing. I hope to be up to 10,000 by research time. I want to do more Naperville work in October. My goal is by the end of October, we're doing more quantitative EEGs in Naperville, hopefully with vets, but we'll take who we can get, I guess.
Wonderful.
All right. And Scott's here. Anybody have any questions? I know there are other people coming online. I wonder where they're all hiding today. So I don't have anything specific on the agenda that I was targeting for today's session. I've been so busy, I haven't had a chance to pause and breathe. Any questions, thoughts, comments? How about you, Scott? Anything coming up for you? No, Scott's, can you put Scott back on too?
Okay, yeah, I'm unmuted now. I did have a question a few weeks ago, and I didn't write it down, and I don't remember what it actually was. I've been kind of learning with these new clients that I'm having that I have to start from scratch with, and realizing how different every single client that walks in is so different that you have to really be very open to make sure that you're tuning into what's the best way to start, what kind of foundation do they need, and what's the way to kind of get starting with them in a way that'll be effective immediately or early, so that they start to feel some results. And so it's kind of interesting learning to be more open and not having the inpatient clients that repeat themselves constantly, and you don't have to be quite as sharp with them. You know, you don't have to be on your toes, but it really reminds me how we have to approach every client very wide open with a lot of consciousness to figure out what approach will be the best and what kind of a foundation do they have. And, you know, to do that as quickly as possible so that they buy into what you're doing, and as well as having to connect with them at the same time. You know, you got to build that initial rapport so that they feel comfortable enough, but also to really pick up on their case and what are some of the primary issues or the most important issue, which they often tell you right off what that is.
Right.
But it just trying to be open and effective very quickly.
Well, a couple things about that. One is I've been doing it in Miraval, which is doing very, very well, actually. And we are drawing in a lot of people. So I'm booked up when I have sessions available. I'm full. So, in fact, I have to add on once I give a talk. Now, normally, remember that for anybody that's coming to you, now you're talking about in your private practice now, right? So are you marketing to a particular kind of population, or is it word of mouth, or how are they hearing about you? Just out of curiosity.
Well, I got a website that's been up a couple of months, and it hasn't even given me one single client yet. So I got a specialist that is helping me to try to get some traffic. But The clients I've had have been either former clients from that were drug addicts and are now out in the public realm and they're working and they need a little bit more, or they have told people that they work with, and so it's basically people that have come to me word of mouth, not complete strangers. Although I don't really know the new people that are showing up, but at least they've been referred with a positive word about it, you know.
Sure. Okay. Well, then a couple of things about that. I mean, I'm working at an integrative wellness spa that attracts everything. So I have people coming in with active addiction. I have people coming in who want they're married to an addict. Probably 30% of the women I work with married a narcissist and are now discovering that and the process of getting out of a marriage to a narcissist. So I'm doing quite a bit of relational kind of reprogramming and like, okay, well, I don't want to marry another narcissist. Thank you very much. So some of it is relational trauma prevention for the future. And that means if they married a narcissist, there is inevitably better than 95, 94%, there's a narcissistic-like parent somewhere in the picture that sets up the attraction on a subconscious level to that type of individual. There's an alcoholic, workaholic, unavailable parent, combination of unavailable parents, something like that. I do a lot of work with narcissism nowadays. That's been quite a focus. We're going from the age of narcissism to the age of empathy. So be prepared for the narcissist to knock down your door. Or knock on your door anyway. They may knock it down too. But and they don't do therapy. So I always tell my clients that the person I'm seeing in my office is usually the healthiest member of the family, not the sickest member of the family. They're open to health. They're open to healing and well-being. Now, as far as accessing the system, people come to me for everything imaginable. Now, shockingly enough, some of the most amazing cases of the last few months are people who were in serious accidents as children, car accidents, whiplash, head, neck, spinal trauma. Sometimes they even forget to think about the accident. They're like, oh, I think I recovered from that. But in reality, they've been in chronic pain or neck pain, back pain, whiplash. I'm like, did you have an injury that caused your pain? No, I don't think so. And then I start working. I'm like, oh, I forgot to tell you. I had a concussion when I was 6. How old are you when you started having migraines? Well, about 3rd grade or something like that. I'm like, okay. So the migraines are probably coming, maybe related to a traumatic event. As they're talking about the migraine, about the accident, the head starts hurting. Like, sure enough, the source of their migraines might very well be originating traumatic event. So whether they come for anxiety, well, probably 20-30% are coming from anxiety issues. If I ask them, do they have panic attacks? Probably of those 40-45% have panic attacks. 55% are generalized anxiety, but significant anxiety. And of course, then you check and ask, be sure and ask if they're on benzodiazepines. I had one I worked on this week. She had been given Xanax about 2 weeks ago based on some anxiety she was having, discovering her husband's affair and some other stuff going on. And, but she was taking it periodically. She wasn't yet dependent on it. And so I was able to work with her and I think she did pretty well, but she was a little fuzzy in some of the reframing. So I think any active use, recent use of Xanax, benzodiazepines, be very careful with that. It could contraindicate HMR, or simply they're going to need to sign that disclaimer at the end of the session, which if you're using the software, they automatically sign to get the report. I have all my client signatures on record for the reports. But that says, you know, the use of a benzodiazepine may prevent the actual reframe. And in one case, when the client, we mentioned her before, was put on benzodiazepines, her seizures actually began to come back after a year when she had not been having any seizures from. So I think HMR can possibly sort of create a new neural pathway for some memory imprints, but it's possible they put them on Xanax, they're actually repressing the new pathways, they're repressing the new memory effects, and they're actually regressing back to a physiological state of seizure or trauma or whatever. But I don't have enough data about that to explain that. Hi, Mr. Meyer. I see Meyer just signed on. And Karen. Hi, Karen. Also, Karen's plural. Yay. And anybody, good to see you again. But as far as way I access this, you know, I do my 6 question. I'll review it with you briefly, but I always start car accidents, whiplash, head, neck, spinal trauma. Because if you have any empathy whatsoever and you sit next to a client that has that active condition, your neurology is disturbed. You're going to be a little headache-ish or uncomfortable sitting next to a person. If you're doing the C7 point, some of you don't. But if you're doing the C7 point, you're going to be uncomfortable sitting next to a person with an active neurological trauma that's still transmitting. And I pick that up almost right away. That's, again, I'm sort of supposed to record as kind of a prototype. But when I have that, I clear that first because the body is creating a state of discomfort that can be felt in the room with a person with a neurological injury or damage. So I always start with head, neck, spinal trauma. And in two cases in the last month, they've been in pain since they were 15 years old and didn't realize they're still in an active memory state. So when it was reframed, they were no longer in pain. Or it was, I think one was 90% diminished, the other was 100% gone. And so check for car accidents, whiplash, head, neck, or spinal trauma. The second is deaths or losses. I do a lot of work with grief. People having lost families and loved ones. I'm getting some back noise, Jeanette, from somebody. Deaths or, that just stopped. Deaths or losses. And so grief issues. People come a lot to Miraval for grief issues, losses, animals, pets, all kinds of things. With deaths, you may remember that we often, ultimately, I almost always do a double reframe with the death. One is, what is the traumatic part? Is it about not being there in time? Is it about how they died? Did they die in pain? You may have to reframe that. You're not getting to say goodbye. And I almost always add on the second reframe, which is, let's invite your mother to be here with us today. Let's invite your loved one to be here. Let's create a living scene, a connection to you and the loved one. And anytime you think that caller, see that caller, go back and connect with your loved one and feel their presence. And so along with the trauma, maybe how they died or how you found out about it or what took place, if it's a prolonged period of illness, you know, I do the pain, the grief pain reduction exercise, which is, let's picture your mom holding out a shoebox in front of her. Let's picture your ex-husband holding out, or your husband holding out a shoebox. Let's put all the videos, the DVDs, all the pain, all the suffering, all the difficult scenes. If they had a miserable, horrible death, that might be a, sometimes I do three reframes of death. I'll reframe the actual moment of death. It was painful and unpleasant. We'll change that. Maybe they die peacefully in their sleep. Sometimes it's like, okay, I'd like to them just pass peacefully without a prolonged illness. Sometimes I need to have them not be in pain when this takes place, or if it's a medical trauma of some sort, have them not die on the operating table or whatever. So it's, again, HMR, as we've discovered, is not about altering the memory history. It's about getting the subconscious unstuck from the pain state that it's sustaining and preserving at the moment they're overwhelmed. And that can be done in an infinite number of ways, I'm convinced, but the client has to accept the solution. So I'd like to have them not be in that much pain and die peacefully. Let's do that. Okay, now if we invited mother also to be here with us, taking a picture of how she looked at me, oh, she looks great. I can't picture mother as she is today. Am I still seeing her suffering? Okay, you're still stuck in the hospital. Are you still stuck in hospice care? We need to reframe the hospice care scene. So with a grief or loss, there can be several T-1 reframes if they have acute moment of pain or suffering, so deaths. So we always reframe the death of the individual. And more often than not, it's like, I'd like to just, you know, have a connection with that person. Let's go, what's your favorite scene? You want to take her to the beach with you? That's your safe scene. Yeah, that would be great. I'd like to go to the beach with her. Let's picture that. So that's a death. So I just start with head, neck, spinal trauma, deaths, losses. And then I start with relationship history with family members. Interestingly enough, I'm discovering that a lot of pain and trauma comes from the siblings and not the parents. So I had one, I can't even tell you how many times. We were discussing siblings this week. Like, oh yeah, well, my sister, you know, one of my clients actually hit her younger sister over the head with a bottle, like a Coke bottle, when she was an infant. I mean, she had several moments and said, oh yeah, well, my brother hit me over the head with a shovel. You know, at one point in time, like, okay, we have homicidal siblings on our hands in this family. So that can be interesting. One of them rolled the bassinet of the younger newborn sibling towards the window, lowered the side of the the baby beds in hopes that the sibling might crawl out of the window onto the second, the window of the second floor and maybe fall off and get killed. So like, you know, indirect manslaughter, homicide of the sibling by trying to eliminate them, tie them to trees. Anyway, sibling rivalry gets quite interesting. The narcissistic siblings will, she who must not be named, we won't mention any names today, right? I'm talking to Glenda. But siblings will be just relentless and will not get it and can be really malicious and hurtful throughout your life. And I had one this week, she says, no brother. I'm eliminating him from the family system. Never had a brother. Don't need that. Whatever that is, that's not a brother. So I don't have a sibling. I'm like, okay, well, that works. It's fine for me if that works for you. She's like, oh yeah, I'll be fine. So several times she's like, I'd like to just not have that brother in my family at all, and gave it back. And I'm working with several clients right now with narcissistic siblings and a narcissistic parent. Apparently they're saying about 25% of narcissism can be genetic, but 3/4 looks like it's probably learned or acquired from behaviors, which is good to know. So in the majority of cases, the woman divorcing the narcissistic husband, the kids will have good genes. They'll be fine because the husband's narcissism is not necessarily genetically predisposed, but can be from a traumatic disconnect from one or both parents before the age of 2. It's the attachment issue that I see is the most common. And as a result of that, I'll say your children are going to be fine. But what you're going to find, most of you in your offices, is that the people that are coming to you, not the narcissist usually, we're getting the victims or the partner of the narcissist. And they are exhausted emotionally. They've been doing double time because the narcissist is one woman had 3 children. I said, well, you got 4, right? She said, absolutely. So you have 4 children. And actually the most, you know, I give cases all the time about, oh yeah, your husband, it's dangerous in the later part of the marriage that if you're really sick, he'll actually put you in a taxi and send you to the hospital. Well, guess what? This week, one of the woman's husbands for the 3rd child, he's like, I'm sorry, I can't be there. I have a business meeting. I'll put you in a taxi and send you to the hospital so you can deliver the 3rd child. He did. He called an Uber and sent her to the hospital for the 3rd child. He was not there for the delivery of their 3rd child. He actually Uberized her. So anyway, sometimes I know, and I say, okay, not only is that meant there for crucial moments, he wasn't even there for the birth of his child. And he did several things like that. He did the same thing with one of the children when they were injured. Like, well, we'll call a taxi. Well, I'll get a limousine for them. We'll send them to the hospital. We'll make sure they get the proper medical care. And he didn't go. He wasn't there. I'm like, you have the true definition of a narcissist on your hands. And later in life, they're quite dangerous because they will not be looking out for your health. So anyway, so in the parenting, look at the parenting reframe. But when you have that occurring, you're going to always want to go back and say, now, how did this occur in your family system? You want to map the family history and what's happening there. Mom, dad, siblings, look at the sibling relationships in the family. A lot of individuals, you know, if you get asked about the siblings, their abuse came from their sibling, not from the parents. But the parents in those cases are, one of the children had kind of special needs upon birth. So when the brother is born, the second child, and is kind of angry, temper tantrums, and has some learning issues, the 3rd child, my client, who is the perfect child and does everything well and shows not to make waves or does anything, that brother starts to take his rage and his anger out on the youngest child. And as a result, the parents are caught up taking care of the 1st child with some special needs. I think she had like cerebral palsy. She was premature, and therefore she had some limitations, and they're trying to deal with that. The brother who's in the black sheep position starts acting out, and he takes everything out on the youngest, particularly on the youngest child, and it's just malicious. And so my client, basically the narcissistic previous, and the mother had a little bit of self-absorption, like, oh my God, this oldest child's gonna kill me. And so the mother was kind of a narcissist victim. The two main things, I actually had a family this week where both of the parents, the father was the classic narcissist, the mother was the narcissist victim. And so look at me, look what life has done to me. And the husband, of course, divorced her, had affairs, divorced the mother. So I have the child who then ends up marrying a narcissist herself and can't figure out how that happened. I said, you have narcissists everywhere. You have the classic narcissist father. You have the narcissist victim mother who's going to spend her whole life upset, whining, what the world owes her. And then that the child, the youngest child that I'm talking about, was very successful. So every time she's like, oh, yeah, I told her I was coming to Mirabal. She looks at it on the internet. Oh, I wish I could go to Mirabal. Nobody ever takes me to nice places like Mirabal. I said, there it is. I said, oh, absolutely. She's like a victim to her dying day. She's like, everybody else has this. I didn't get that. And she said, and she's always competed with me. Every time I told her what I did successfully, she tried to tell me what she did successfully, what she had just done recently, what she needed to be doing recently. I said, classic narcissism. So a lot of that is coming out. But in the patterns with the narcissistic systems, look for the origin in either the traditional or the narcissistic victim parent. And then look and see if they've repeated it. And what I always tell my clients, as you know, many of you, is like, okay, if it occurs three times, it'll also show up in your astrology chart, which we have in there, excellent astrologers. But I'll say if it shows up in your astrology chart, or if it shows up three times in your life, you're here to end that pattern. And you've had it four times or five times. And you're not to repeat that. You're not here. And they go, oh, you mean I'm not here? She says, I'm not dating anymore. I will not date a narcissist. I'm not going to go there. I said, you know, your subconscious is still transmitting your original default definitions of love from your heart meridians. And there are two heart meridians, and those of you that are energy sensitive and aware of that or aware that the heart has the two meridians, if they have not reset, if you have not done reparenting with them. So when I get the narcissist, the clients divorcing the narcissist, I said, while you're here, Mirabal, or in my private practice, got people flying in and we always do the reparenting. You want to do the reparenting because you have to change the signal being transmitted by the subconscious that is still attracting the default definition of love. And if the default definition of love, what was mom and dad like? Were they, like, you remember my questions, mom and dad, did they give hugs, say, I love you? Were they emotionally available? You know, were, what did dad do for a living? Was mom a stay-at-home mom or did they both work? If that's the case, who raised you? The youngest of the three children, the narcissistic, the client whose both parents are narcissists, oh, I raised myself. I said, exactly. And her first memory, one thing I'll mention, the first memory a client presents you with in an HMR session often sets the theme for the therapy. Her first memory is, I said, where are you? She says, I'm sitting in the front yard. How old are you? About six. What happened? I came home from school. What happens then? I'm just sitting there. I have a key around my neck. She says, I'm waiting, you know, I'm getting off the bus. And she says, I'm sitting down and I'm all by myself. She says, then I just have to go in the house and take care of myself. I'm locked in the house. I said, you're a latchkey kid. She said, yeah, most of my childhood. Dad's gone, mom's out, and she's, you know, at work, whatever. And so I raised myself most of my childhood. And all of her, almost every memory she came up with in that session was about isolation, aloneness, lack of support, nobody there for you. So the first memory a client presents with, though it may seem insignificant, like, oh, just sitting there alone, that is the theme probably of maybe her entire therapy with you, but that's certainly the opening scene, like of the aria, the opera here, okay? This is our opening scene. It's setting the theme. The theme is you're alone. There's nobody there for you. Nobody there with you. And her entire session was that way. They all related to themes of isolation alone. She got it. She said, there it is. She's at my fifth marriage. She said, I'm alone again. There it is. You know, my marriage, like I'm telling you, we have things to do. He runs off. He's left. He's gone on a trip. And then the other memory being, you know, being put in an Uber to deliver her third child. It was cesarean. You know, it was planned. But nonetheless, it's like, hello, I'll put you in an Uber, send you to the hospital. I won't be able to make the third birth. But he wasn't there with the second child either. So, and that's when also you get depression issues for the client. She was put on antidepressants by her psychiatrist. Were you depressed? Well, yeah, her husband hasn't been there after the first, marginally there for the first child, not there for the second, and Uberized her for the third child. So I'm like, hello, this is crazy stuff. This is not happening here. So I said, of course, and you deserve better. So when we reset, did the reparenting, reset the subconscious definition, she was very clear. Says, I've been doing this. If people have trouble with the reparenting exercise, you rephrase the question. And I may have mentioned this, but I'll mention it again. Another way, they're like, well, I feel guilty. I feel good. I said, no, you don't get it. We're not doing anything. Your parents are your parents. We're grateful. You wouldn't be the lovely person you are today without your genetics. We're not changing your parents. I said, what I'm really asking you is, can you use what your mother and father taught you I said, do you have children? Someone said yes, someone said no. I said, if you had a child, could you use what your mother and father taught you to raise your children in a healthy manner? Oh, no, 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 not at all. I tried to do the opposite. I said, then even as a teenager or young adult, you fired your parents and brought in a new software program a long time ago. So the reparenting exercise is the opportunity to articulate the values and qualities of the two healthy parents and of a healthy marriage and install that in your computer so your subconscious is starting to attract healthy. Because if you're not attracting healthy from your subconscious and you know that you're still attracting unavailable males or females, whatever, then you have to reset your definitions. And this reparenting exercise is actually the opportunity to articulate the entire value system of what a healthy mom would be, healthy dad would be, and the healthy marriage, and then begin incorporating that exercise into each of the memories as they come up. So inevitably, when we do the reparenting, let's go back to your 12-year-old that's at home and fighting with your mother, and she's screaming at you and doing her narcissistic thing. And I said, what do you need to do with that when she's shaming you? One of the narcissistic victim mothers, is she had a memory at 10 of having a period, her first period, I think, in the hallway at school. And the school called her mother, and the mother said, send her home in a taxi. The mother lives 10 minutes away, and the mother said, just send her home in a taxi. And the school said, well, you know, they started discussing, should we send her in an ambulance? She's like, oh my God, no. Because the 10-year-old figured out what it was. She says, oh, I think I'm just having my period, and I just need to have my mother come and get me. The mother lived 10 minutes away, wouldn't come get her. When she got home, the mother was sewing, knowing nothing significant. And the child's shocked. She's like, okay, you said you had something, you couldn't come, you were busy, and you're here just sewing. And she's not a seamstress or anything, she's just sewing something. And so the mother just like, no, I don't want to go to school. I don't want to go pick her up. Send her in a taxi. And then the school was horrified. Then when she got home, it just continued. So she's like, done, fired, mother's gone, brought in the new mom, did the reparenting piece. And so she began in every case to bring in the new mother features. And then she was able to go all the way through the reparenting exercise and say, now, what color would you be if you had two healthy parents? What are the frequencies? What would your future soulmate look like? And by the end of the first session with this new client, she's like, all right, I'm picturing a husband and his colors were blue and yellow. So when she was leaving, I said, remember, you know, you're this color and you're attracting to you. She says, yeah, I know the blue and yellow. I'm looking for blue. And she was smiling and she came in so like, I don't think I ever want to date again. I don't think I can do that. I said, I don't understand why, but I don't feel like I would attract healthy. And I said, that's why we do all therapy is reparenting. I said, and it's true, I do an accelerated version of this. I know, Scott, you're talking about creating safety and doing this. I have to work in a spa setting where people are coming in. Now, they're pretty personally motivated. Most of them are fairly successful. They're grounded to some extent. And I always do the grounding exercise at the end. But they have other therapies available to them while they're there that are very advanced. Some of them are quite excellent. We have a woman who does intuitive massage who always pretty much repeats back to them what I just saw with them in the session. She's like, oh, wow, you had your grandmother die not long ago. They'll pick up things. And so we're in a pretty elevated spiritual atmosphere at Miraval. We're doing some amazing work there. And there are three or four practitioners I'll send my trauma people to. One does a combination of cranial sacral and acupuncture at the same time. And she's excellent. Kari does a cranial acupuncture combination and releases a lot of trauma that way. So I'll send them to Kari. At Miraval, they're doing yoga, they're doing floating meditations, they're grounding, they're doing grief presentations, workshops. So I do have an advantage in that by the time they get to me or find me, they've often done some pretty grounding exercises, their bodies are calmer, they've usually had a couple of days at Miraval, the containment, the atmosphere. So I have an advantage in that, Scott, if you're getting them off the street or wherever they're coming in from, you know, I do have an advantage in that they've had some excellent body work. They are a little more grounded in their bodies. They've often done some acupuncture. They've been to the floating meditations or the Aqua Zen meditations. They do Tibetan bowls in the water that accesses things in the body vibrationally. They're doing some pretty advanced things at this point. So when I can refer them to that or have them do the work, my work with them moves faster, a little easier. I'd like to see a treatment center someday where we've integrated quantitative EEGs, because when we work with Jim Kowal, and we did the measurements. It was fascinating because I didn't have to tell him. My first client, a 10-year-old, came in. I did a session with her. I touched her. I was nauseated. I asked her mother, did she have a concussion? I said, why is she here? She started a year ago having seizures. I said, well, she's had a concussion. And I said, but the seizures didn't start until a year ago, but she just turned 8. She had the concussion, first concussion, forceps at birth, and then she fell off the changing table as an infant, so in her first year. So if it were to be like a 7-year cycle, they would start around the year, age of 8, which they did. I think the day I saw her, she turned 9 or something like that, I believe. But anyway, when I reframed it with her, at least in the months that followed, I think the seizure stopped. And then I don't know what happened after that. I think they moved away and went to another city. But when Jim Kowal looked at the quantitative EEGs, like he walked up to me and said, does that client you worked on, the young girl, does she have seizures? I said, yes, as a matter of fact, she does. That's why she's here. He said, I see it in the brainwave scans. And this was the pre-scan. And I said, it's going to be interesting to see. And by at the end, the scan afterwards had diminished somewhat. It was better. But, and all four memories that we worked on, the only two she had that were conscious. And that's another thing. I'm doing more work with memories that the client doesn't consciously have. They've either been reported to them by family members, or I'm accessing and asking them, and they call the family or check and say, oh yeah. One of them, I think I mentioned, did I mention this one to you last time? I think I did. I think it was over a month ago, about the woman with the electric blanket, that the child was left in an electric blanket when she was 9.5 months old. And when I went to scan her, she had not reported that. She wasn't sure what to think about it. When I went to scan her, I felt electricity in my head and I got a headache. And I said, I've never asked this, have you had an electrical trauma to your brain? And she said, well, I was put in an electric blanket when I was 9.5 months old. Either they hit the high button, I hit my foot at the high button, and went up. So when they found me, I was unconscious. They brought my fever down to 104, rushed me to the hospital. The nurses said, it's amazing, my brain didn't boil. So anyway, I am still picking up head injuries and traumas that they have not reported in taking the history. So some of you ask, what's the advantage of being an empath? What's the advantage of learning to scan? You know what? Once you get a little more sensitive, you've been practicing it, your hand will hurt over a head injury. You will feel a pain in your hand if you're scanning. Now, some of you don't do that. If you're inpatient, you're probably not going to be waving your hands looking like Harry Potter, you know, but the truth is you can actually scan a client. Mirabal, I'm at a spa. Actually, you know what I found out is Mirabal is not a HIPAA-required facility. They're a hotel. So unless a client actually subpoenas them for some reason, what do you do, subpoena a hotel record? Why are you subpoenaing a hotel record? Now, I follow HIPAA guidelines on my software, you know, for the notes, but I don't have to take client notes. The only notes I take are HMR notes, which are actually not HIPAA required. The HIPAA notes that show memory sequencing and a summary of the memories and the details, these are technically worksheets, HMR worksheets. And that is not included under HIPAA required guidelines, as I understand it. Now, so Scott, one of the questions we'll have to talk about with Jeanette is, if you're taking notes, you know, you were encouraged to take absolutely clean but minimal notes. The facility, inpatient facilities always said take clear but minimal information, the necessary minimal information when you're taking notes about your client. So the fact that they did one memory at age 2 and a second memory at age 5 and third memory at age 14 and the fifth memory, HIPAA does not require that level of detail. That's an HMR detail, but that's the detail I send my clients home with every. And every single client, they even call back and say, I lost my notes, please send me another copy. So except for one woman whose daughters were there with her, she's like, I don't think I want my daughters to know that I had a child before I was married. They don't know they have another sibling. She's like, so I don't think I want those notes lying around my hotel room while I'm here at your home. I was like, well, you don't have to have the copy of the notes. That's not necessary. But the majority of people want the worksheets. They want to see the summary of the memories, the sequencing. They want a map of the body. They want to see where the memories occurred in the body, and they're taking that home with them at the end of the session. Those of you that are board members, you have access to the software, so you can use it. It seems to be working pretty well as far as that goes. So up to family sequencing. Getting the data. So the prehistory, head, neck, spinal trauma, deaths, losses. I always ask for the family relational history starting with the siblings. So they say, oh, you have two alcoholic siblings, and one with schizophrenia, and one with all of us have depression, anxiety. I'll already know what to look for in the history of the grandparents. And I use the siblings kind of as a clue what the parents are going to actually have as their qualities. In the majority of cases, you can see where it came from. You know, my brothers are alcoholic. Okay, we got to find the alcoholism in the family. Then we have the THIQ talk. So I print two articles on alcoholism and addiction. Those of you that are working with addicts, so Scott, if you're working with addicts, I print the THIQ article and give it to them. And they ask for that because I'm like, yeah, read this to your children. AA has now adopted the THIQ theory that the brain is converting alcohol into a narcotic, which accumulates in the center of the brain. Anyway, you can look up the, maybe Jeanette, I'll have Jeanette send you the version I use of the THIQ article for your alcoholic clients or whose husbands are alcoholic and the children might be alcoholic, even if the client is not. And then there's the second article that I send them on cardiovascular damage from alcoholism, because they publish more and more information that, you know, it starts with high blood pressure, goes to atrial fibrillation, then moves on to heart attack, stroke, and aneurysm. And so we know more about cardiovascular damage. And I'm doing probably 30% of my clients have some alcohol or alcohol-related type trauma in their histories. With addiction. So that's there. Also, you know, the discussion we had about pot marijuana, I had a couple of clients come in who were smoking pot regularly and seemed to be having difficulty accessing memory. Now, I need Mary Gaddy to come online with this. I need to talk with her because she was going to do some research for me about the effects of CBD and marijuana. Now, I was thinking about it and talking about it. Clearly, marijuana is disrupting alpha theta. Because if it stops their nightmares and stops their dreams and they get black sleep, then it's obvious that some of the marijuana is definitely impacting the alpha theta brainwave state, which means they're not getting rest either. Because if you disrupt alpha theta, you're not getting REM. So the client smoking pot, they may feel like they're getting drowsy and going to sleep, but they're not getting REM sleep. They're disrupting their dream states, which means they're not releasing subconsciously when they're asleep dreaming after marijuana. So I was wondering, because like some of the clients are looking pretty agitated, you know, though, you know, that they were smoking pot or whatever. And I'm like, I just say the same thing. Also, from what I can determine, it takes quite a dosage of CBD oil for it to become a clinical dosage. You could be bankrupt at the price they're charging for the CBD oil. So I'm like, by the time, and besides, you want to heal the memories and not actually have to go back to that space. So. Anyway, so I do a drug history, like, what are you taking? Are you smoking anything? Oh, I smoke pot regularly. So I worked with a young man more recently, and he wasn't drinking, though alcoholism is in his history, but he was dying marijuana. Now, both alcohol and pot are depressants. They don't realize that, but they both make you feel a little euphoric when you use them, but they're both depressants. And they're both, alcohol and pot, both disrupt alpha theta. They both disrupt REM sleep. So you're not getting deeper rest if you're doing it before bedtime. You're probably disturbing, you're not getting the release from your dreams, because if it disrupts alpha theta, you're not getting the release from your dream states. So these are just some things to keep in mind. Clearly, if it's creating black sleep and you have no memory, no imagery, nothing from the nightmares stop, then you're not getting any discharge in your sleep states. It's disrupting them. So that I can already tell you just as an external observer. But I want Mary Gaddy to give me a little more research data. I'd like to, Jim Kowal knows the brainwave frequencies for the benzodiazepines. If you have any question about benzos, you can call Jim in Naperville in Illinois. They actually have mapped the brainwave states of the benzo users. That's why we exclude them from our research before I heard his findings. He's like, you know, you're exactly right. How did you find that out? I said, I watched my clients. I said, they're not able to hold the reframe. He says, yeah, because I think it's Xanax drops you down like 40 hertz. Clonopin down to 50 hertz. It's still low, but not the lowest. But he says the lower you get, the harder it is to sort of, it's kind of like growing the new neural pathways. You can't take in the new information. So depending on whether your client's there for family issues, marital issues, you're right, Scott, in talking about what did they come for. Sometimes they think they're there for all health. When you go to talk to them about their health, you're like, okay, number one is also watch for the empaths, because some of the pain they're taking in is from their parents and loved ones. And they're taking in issues and pain from, probably 30% of the women I see a pretty strong empath. They find Miraval, they read some of my books, information. They're like, yeah, I'm an empath. I take in stuff. And then of those empaths you're working with, 20, 30% of them marry narcissists, because narcissists are attracted to women who will emotionally compensate for their narcissism. So narcissists are attracting empathic individuals. And they look good, sound good, say all the right things, do not act at all like the narcissistic parent. They look good, sound good, present themselves well, because all the women are saying, how did I miss this? How did I miss this? Probably 40%, 50% of the women I work with who married a narcissist, like, how did I not see this for the first 10, 15 years? How did I not notice? I said, he didn't show you that part. It's not until he felt like his needs were not being met that he went off, you know, off planet here, so to speak, started having affairs and, you know, putting money away and doing all kinds of strange things. So anyway, that's a little bit from the marital standpoint, relational standpoint. I always start with the family history and then go from there. Sometimes the trauma was from school or educational systems, bullying. Most of you are familiar. I get a percentage of parents. I'm better and better at getting ADD clients, because they're gonna give you. You try to take a history from your ADD client. What do you notice? You're gonna get a story. They're gonna be circling. They're gonna give you all the peripherals. You try to. Had a woman. She was a lawyer, very successful. I did not think from her history there would be ADD, but I kept trying to answer, do a session with her and ask, take her history. And every time I started taking history, she went off on a tangent about the grandmother or something that happened when she was a little girl in school or whatever. And like, did you have any learning issues? She says, oh no, I was very bright in school. She says, but I often wondered if I was kind of ADD or not. She says, because my tracking, so my focusing ability. She says, I got through law school, but I really had to work at it. She says, I kept kind of moving off the main focal point. I said, yeah, you know, I said, you might want to be assessed for that. But I said, it was the most exhausting session I've done with an adult in a long time. So she learned to intellectually focus and compensate. But I'm pretty sure as a child, she was ADHD. She said, I did have some reading and writing issues in grade school. I said, yeah, I said, you were smart, you overcame it. But I said, you're showing active symptoms, your processing is cyclical, not linear. And you know, it's taking us a little bit longer to get your history. And I talked with her very gently, kindly about that. But I said, you may want to do a second session, because we're going to be limited in the number of memories we can do in the session. Because her history, when you have an ADD person, they're going to elaborate on the details of the history. You got to keep bringing them back. So the history will take twice as long. So they end up, if you're doing inpatient or you're doing ongoing sessions, that's not a problem. In a spa setting where they only come for one session, not sure if they need a second, I'm like, you may want to do a second session, and you have a choice of 50 or 80. I said, if you want to do more memories, I'd go for 80. And they did. And so, particularly with the ADD client taking a history, it's going to take longer, and you're going to need additional time or an additional session. If they're seeing you on a regular basis, it's just going to take a longer time to do the HMR. You can pull them back and help them focus and bring them back to the process, but it's going to be a challenge. So let's see. So through history, and then when it comes to anxiety, depression, addiction, I do ask them about their drinking. I'm pretty aware of them when they're minimizing their content, you know, like, oh, I do drink occasionally. I said, is it in your family history? Oh, yeah, well, my mother's kind of a functional alcoholic. All they got to do is say that, and we're going to have the THIQ talk. And more often than not, when I see them, it's on the anniversary. It's on a 7-year anniversary. I see clients at 42. I see clients at 49. I see clients at 56 or 54 or 55, you know, within the year. Or they came for their 55th birthday or 56th birthday. They're coming at a pivotal moment when they're at the end of a 7-year cycle. And I'm like, okay, you need to know about this alcohol thing that's going on. I said, let's have the talk about that. And I said, you're here probably to become sober at this point. I said, like, do you ever have a glass of wine and you get flushed, turned red? You know, they found the link between the alcoholism genes and cardiovascular problems in the past few years. So it's causing, you know, heart attack, stroke, aneurysm, you know, but they start by getting flushed when they drink. I said, I tell my clients to get the blood pressure cuff out. I said, here's my test I developed. Nobody ever told me about this. I said, get a blood pressure cuff. Take your blood pressure. Have your glass or two of wine, and then take your blood pressure afterwards. According to the wine company, you're supposed to be going down and relaxing. I said, if your blood pressure is spiking, going up, going off the charts, I said, you're in the vascular damage territory. This is not good. And that's the way we measure it. That's the way we gauge it. I said, if you're going up, and people say, oh, yeah, I do that. I used to drink and I was fine. Now I drink, I get flushed, I turn red, and I feel my pulse increasing. I said, you need to stop now. However you need to do that, you're in vascular damage territory. And so we know now. Remember the Irishman with the burst capillaries in the nose? We know that piece from the alcoholism section. So I spend probably a third of, not a third, but a third of the clients I see have an alcohol-related issue, either in the spouse. If they have it, the children need to be informed. So I'll say, I just got an email today, like, I was in your session last Sunday, and you mentioned the THIQ article, but I didn't see the cardio article. I said, no, I ran out. She said, would you have that email that to me? Because I want to show it to my kids and grandkids. I want them to know that there's a risk factor involved. And I said, yeah, if you let them read the article, leave the THIQ article lying around because it's significant. And I said, we do know that the brain is converting into a very addictive narcotic, and that explains your elevator theory. The floor you stop at will always be the floor you resume at in drinking. And so I'm still doing quite a bit of addictions work, even in, in a non-clinical setting. And so I imagine we're going to find that a third of the average population at least has some alcohol-related issues. What's interesting is the percentage of marital difficulties that are alcohol and are drug-related. I think alcohol is a much more significant factor than we previously gave it credit for. But when I was in the seminary, they used to say 83 to 85% of marriage cases you will counsel will be alcohol-related. I was like, well, give us information on alcohol. So they gave us 1 3-hour lecture. I was like, I don't think that's going to do it. We need more info. So I spent a whole summer studying addictions and alcoholism on my own. And here we are, became a licensed addictions counselor. So that was a wise decision because a huge percentage of marital challenges and coping is alcohol and drug related nowadays. So we're getting through the history there. The other two things, and some people just come in thinking they're just working on their health issues, but I'll say even indirectly, anytime you work on your memories and heal your memories, you're dropping your cortisol levels, you're reducing cortisol response on a daily basis, an hourly basis. When you bring your cortisol levels down, your thymus cell production, your immunity go up, and you're much more likely to be able to recover from an autoimmune challenge if you're boosting your immune system. So I said, those clients come in generally in those areas, like, okay, I have migraines, I have headaches, panic attacks. I can target that right away. Sometimes they're coming in with deaths or losses. I had a traumatic death or loss. So let's start working with that. And you can target a specific memory. You remember with HMR, when you think about that event, where do you feel that in your body? You said your grandmother died last week. Can you see where you are when you're feeling all this sadness about your grandmother's death? Now, there's a chance when you say, how old are you when you first feel that? They would go back to a much earlier loss in their lives. One of the principles that we cover now at level 3 is the compounding of an emotional trigger. Like if there's an earlier grief, then the degree of your grief response in 2020 will be amplified by all the previous grief memories that are left unresolved in the subconscious. The subconscious pulls it together and associates it. So the recent event is just the trigger event. And clients often say, I don't know why I'm here, but I had one little thing happen about 2 weeks ago. And I just felt like I fell apart. I said, then it's not just about that. And this is what we know about memory and memory association and sympathetic resonance. So anything similar about abandonment or loss is going to bring up your entire abandonment, grief history. And we're going to end up working on a pattern. Then I tell them about the software. That's what the software does. We're going to look at the memory history. Like if you've been, and like with the client with the loneliness, she says, yeah, look, all the memories, this whole sequence you're showing me. I've been lonely my whole life. I've been alone. I said, you had double narcissists. And I said, then you married one. I said, you know what I can tell you that's exciting? You're not here to end up your life with a narcissist. It's in your face. You're here to do it differently. You're here to learn to love yourself, take care of yourself. Now, if he can get recovery, whatever, there's hope for that. But you can get recovery no matter what they do or don't do. I said, thank God the kids have you. Thank God that you're here and you've taken care of yourself. Because your kids, you're their best chance. Just, yeah, they kind of need them. He doesn't really connect with them, And God forbid, get prepared. The divorces by the narcissists are malicious. They're horrible. And there's no ethics there. They're going to go for everything they can get. And then the wise a lot of times are just grateful to come out alive. I mean, they're bringing the worst lawyers. That's just going to be a terrible legal thing. But anyway, so divorces, divorcing the narcissist, that's almost a whole separate session altogether. But keep that in mind. It's you're going to need to work with your client to keep sane, hopefully have enough resources to have good lawyers and just deal with it. Because you're dealing with a really angry, hurt two-year-old that's running the show. So last thing, anything else that comes up? So I tend to take a history, and then once we activate that history, I'll say, what does your body tell us? And that's what's interesting. Sometimes what you think the session is going to be about and what the client's 5% thinks the session is going to be about is not at all what the session really turns out to be. It turns out to be a whole different theme or an issue. So I believe what I tell my clients in general is that the technique is mostly working with your subconscious mind, not your conscious mind. That the technique targets and has your subconscious tell us, what do you need to work on? And it's always fun and exciting when you say, oh, look, it's in my neck. Oh, it's in my shoulder. Is this normal? It's supposed to kind of bop around like this? I said, yeah, I call it the pinball effect. It's like a pinball machine. The minute you get the first authentic memory, the body will take over and start showing you the sequencing and the order of the memories. And it will guide you through the process. And that's exactly what it does. So as far as that goes, Scott, I get everything. I get people come in from all over the place with traumas and issues. They're referred to me by other therapists at Miraval when they see an issue or something coming up for them. They know for migraines. They know for panic attacks. I worked on a girl in front of the group who was having a migraine, a partial migraine, in my last lecture. And I do that now. My last lecture had like 22 people. And 5 of them were migraine sufferers. And I was like, anybody having a migraine today? And the girl kind of raised her hand. She's like, I didn't when I came in, but she says, as you're talking, my head's starting to pulse. I said, if that continues and it gets a little worse, your body's volunteering you. So sure enough, she came up and she got in the chair. The first thing we worked on was a migraine, but the second memory was radiating from her neck up into her head and was not directly migraine related. It was contributing. And I said, when those memories start moving around, that's not a migraine sequence. Oh, yeah. I said, that's not a single migraine. That's a migraine sequence of memories. And your body's mapping for you a history of stress. And she was a very high level empath, very, very sensitive in her family and the youngest. And she signed up for actually 2 sessions after that and did excellent work and then referred her roommate who was having migraines. So anyway, did excellent work and did a really good job with that. And probably is going to end up training in the technique too, because she's like a health and wellness coach kind of a thing, but was having occasional migraines. So I see everything at Miraval. It's not like there's one particular clientele that we do with that. Let's make sure, Scott, I don't have that many people in Colorado too that are doing HMR. So the sooner we can get you up, I'll list you on my website, even if you're not certified yet. If you're a licensed professional and you've done at least level 1 and 2 and the healing intensive, and in your case, you've done so many memories, I list you anyway. So if we don't have you up, do we have you on the website already, Scott? Oh, yes, she has you muted. I don't know if Jeanette's there. Okay. I saw you unmute for a second there, but it went back.
I'm here. He's unmuted.
Okay.
I haven't been certified by you yet, but I've done 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah. You know, just send Jeanette your information. Okay. And we'll list you on the website as in training, but you know, you're competent. You've done, I forgot how many sessions, 3,500 sessions, the HMR sessions. You're like 10 times the requirement for certification. So, you know, we'll go ahead and put you up now and list you, so you'll get referrals from there. And I have people, what part of Colorado are you in? Remind me, what are you nearest? What region are you?
I'm in western Colorado, about 220 miles from Denver, west of Denver, on the other side of the west side of the Rocky Mountains.
Okay.
Facing Utah.
All right. So it would take a while to get to you. Are you ever in Denver? You don't practice there.
No, it's about a 5-hour ride to Denver. I'm about 4 or 5 hours from Salt Lake and a few hours from Durango, which is down in southern Colorado. But Grand Junction's only got about 120 25,000 people in this valley with some other towns around it.
Okay. Anyway, I'll keep that in mind, but I've had people from Denver this week, like two or three people coming from Denver. So I can make some Colorado referrals, and they might want to drive out and do some intensive work with you. So anyway, let's just keep that in mind and get Jeanette your information about website and how to contact you. Okay?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know if that helped a little bit about grounding, safety. You know, I have advantages because these people are doing other kinds of grounding techniques and breath work and yoga and meditation. So they, after a day or two or 3 days of that, then they see me. I have a lot more stability in the settings that I'm working in and working with people for first-time trauma work. A lot of them have already worked with therapists. I'm at a pretty high level of people that are motivated and they have resources. So that's why I've always liked working at Miraval. Now, 50% of my practice is I'm booked up into April now with people flying in Sunday through Wednesday. Actually, somebody's planning to fly in Sunday and stay through Friday. And they do two opening sessions Sunday, two sessions Monday, one on Tuesday, a break Tuesday afternoon, two sessions on Wednesday, probably one on Thursday and one on Friday. And they're doing a huge amount of work. Not most people by Wednesday night are fried. They're like, I've done enough. I've done 50 to 75 memories with you and I need to go home. I'm like, okay, good. No, I'm just kidding. That's not that bad. It's like time to recover and reground myself in my body with that many memories. But the nice part is when we get to people that are committed, and I could see you easily doing that, Scott, wherever you are, people come in and want to do a couple of days of work. And that's true for all of you, especially if you're one or the only person. Karen, how many people in Vietnam are doing this? Not many people, like one or two, right? So, you know, do we have trauma in Vietnam? I would think so, probably at this point. So, you know, people could come in and work with you. Deb will do several days in a row of intensive work. And that's another option for your practice. Start looking at, because say, here's what we can do. If you want to come in and do a couple of days work, these are openings that I have for people to come in and do intensive work. You're going to take care of yourself. I think I'm booking like sometimes 3 weeks a month where I'll do that. And then I take a week off. It's just, it's more demanding on you as the facilitator because you're staying on top of the entire sequence of memories they're doing and looking for patterns. But you get to do a lot of work in a short amount of time. And they had one girl, she'd never been able to fly on airplanes without having practically panic attacks when I finished working with her. By the time she left, she flew home for the first time with no anxiety on the plane, nothing. She was good. So I'm working with a lot of it really does turn out to be memory based. And HMR will carry you through a lot of it. So any other questions, those that you have about grounding or safety beforehand? Nope, I think everybody's muted right now. Jeanette, can you turn on the mic? Yeah, Karen.
Not a question, but a comment. I have a lot of people come out of the blue, you know, from referral. Mm-hmm. And what has worked is to tell them, I send them to your website always when I get the first phone call. Mm-hmm. And answer any questions they have. But then when they sit down, I like to start with whatever questions they have and tell them that this therapy is so very different from regular talk therapy. We're going to go with the body. So right. they need to tell me is whatever they'll feel like, whatever they feel impressed to tell me. But I don't need all the details or all the history because I want to be sure we have time to give them some relief.
Right.
And I also tell them now that I have lots of options. And so please honor themselves and our work together. If anything feels uncomfortable, just speak up and we go in a different direction. And those few sentences seem to help. And then I just go totally with the body. Mm-hmm. I do keep the notes of what they said they wanted to deal with. And if it doesn't come up in the body toward the end of the session, I'll ask.
Bring it up, yeah.
But most of the time it's handled in the session and it's, you know, shame first or helplessness or hopelessness. Not the kind of thing you would get from regular talk therapy, but the body says, until I do this, I don't feel worthy or deserving of healing the big stuff.
Right.
So it just... That has been the most successful recently for me.
Very good. Yeah, I think, what you were saying about giving them options about what they want to look at or if they're uncomfortable. We have 5 YouTube videos out now. Mm-hmm. I think most of you are aware of that. So I just refer all my clients, and a lot of them have already said, oh, I watched your 90-minute video. So I was like, oh, good, then I can shorten the introduction to the technique and we can work. So I really do encourage them to go to the YouTube videos. You know, I have the 2 90 minutes that were similar to my talk that I do at Miraval every week. And every time I do that talk, people sign up or I'm booked. The minute they hear the talk, I'm like, oh my goodness, I didn't realize the trauma included stress, anxiety, bullying, being teased as a child, you know, all kinds of things that start coming to mind. They start, as they watch the video, memories come up. And I give examples. So they're like, oh yeah, I had migraines as a child. I didn't think about that. So watching the videos helps them in advance work with you a little faster. It gives them a good introduction. I have the 34-minute where I explain the technique in my own language. There's a 20-minute that if their attention span is very small, they can do the 20-minute, the 7 breakthroughs that led to the technique. And then I'm referring everybody. They're my sister's migraines. I said, oh. I said, well, you know, if after you've seen me, you have anything come back that's a little different. I said, the Migraine Ease video is free. It's online. It's on YouTube now. It's available. And at 8.3 into the video, the exercise begins. So if you need to bypass all the medical cautions and disclaimers I put in, go to 8.3 and they're straight into the Migraine Ease video. And they're using it, apparently. So reframe the original migraine. Picture safety, run the colors to your body, learn to use your colors, and it seems to be working. So, but the YouTube, yeah, so that's a resource, that's free. Give them the introduction. You don't have to explain. If they have questions, say you watched the YouTube video, yes, okay. So here's what's going on, here's how the technique works, what it does. And it's really about you taking yourself out of the past and establishing true, you can market it as mindfulness with respect to your body as memory. Mindfulness for memory. It's very popular in all the treatment centers now. It's mindfulness, being in the present moment. Yoga for mindfulness. So what you're doing, HMR is about being mindful and back in the present moment and not stuck in the static state of trance that the trauma puts you into. Trauma, by definition, is a self-hypnotic state the body goes into to protect you from overwhelm. So you don't need to be hypnotized. You don't need hypnosis per se. You're already hypnotized. Even the National Guild will say you don't need all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. They said you're already hypnotized by trauma. That's what a trauma is, a self-hypnotic state. We found a way using 3 languages. What are our 3 languages? The body, right? Color and energy, mostly color, brainwave frequency, to create sufficient linguistic safety, to create an affective bridge from the 5% conscious to the 95% to say, thank you for holding on to this. But look, I'm at Miraval. Look, I'm in April Lisa's office. Look, I'm in Antonescu. I'm safe. I'm in Karen's office. The bad thing is over. But if you don't prove to the body that it's over, you're destined to relive it indefinitely. Your body is maintaining your pain to protect you and warn you. If you're not in the trance, you don't need the protection anymore. The bad thing is over. And the shock when we do the reframing is a majority of neck pain, back pain, whiplash, migraines, panic attacks, most anxiety and depression, at least 85 to 90% of situation was memory-based. In the past, what I tell my clients is, you did talk therapy? Yes. How many years? 13 years? Twice a week? You know, did psychoanalysis? I said, that's a home in the Hamptons. So I don't tell them that, but actually, they probably paid for one. But I said, that's good. But, you know, when I put my hand on the back of a number of clients that did psychoanalysis for a very long time, when they talk about the memories, the trances were still intact. Nobody talked to the memory. They had to talk about the memories and talked about the history. But if you don't talk and access the memory, it doesn't fully release. And so basically, they kind of get it at that point. And so it's a little therapy trauma. Oh, I thought I released it in the past. Well, if it comes up and you don't worry about it, like Karen said, go to the body. Let the body guide you. Body's brilliant. It has all the memories, and it'll give them things that they forgot about, have no memory of. And sometimes it doesn't talk to them directly, it'll talk to the therapist, the facilitator. So every week I get like, what happened to your head over here on the right? Oh, I forgot. See, I have a scar there. I was like, no, I didn't look at your head that closely, but you have a scar there. My mother was chasing me with a frying pan. I fell and cut my head, and then she felt bad and had to have stitches. I'm like, well, we probably want to reframe that, you know, and work with your mother issues, you know, in your head. So the body will give it to you, even if the client doesn't. So some percentage of memory I see every week is not conscious memory. Some of them have no idea it even happened until they call and ask the family, you know, but I'm getting better at it. But the body's like, please do resolve this, because they may never remember it and have a neurological incident as an elderly adult and have no idea where it came from if you don't ask that question. So as an empath, you have a gift. If you're empathic, develop your gift. Put your hand near the client when you're working on them, because, you know, but I don't tell them what I'm picking up. I ask them a question. Did you ever have an electrical trauma to your brain? So weird you would ask that. You know, I was putting an electric blanket. I'm like, what the heck? You know, and then of course I'm at a conference and I walk in and I get the same kind of headache. And the woman announces, one of the top psychic mediums in the world, actually, was sitting at the table. I said, let me ask you a question. Have you ever had some kind of a head trauma? And before I even asked it, she's like, oh, when I had an adolescent, they thought I was crazy when I heard voices. So they gave me electroconvulsive therapy. They gave me shock therapy. And I'm like, you know, I'd love to work on you sometime if you have a chance, because I'm afraid, I didn't want to say, you still have electric static coming off your brain from the ECT when you were in your 20s, but you do. I mean, they're still emitting a distortion field from the electroconvulsive therapy when they were in their teens. And I'm like, you know, but I can't make people do therapy. I just like, I'd like to encourage you to think about detraumatizing your brain from the electric shock they gave you when you were in your 20s. So I have no idea where this is going. Give me another 20 years and who knows what we'll be able to pick up. I'm just supposed to document it, because the kids that come in with less trauma than we have will do this 10 times faster. They'll probably just sit next to a person and say, oh, did you have a trauma like this as a child? And pick up the migraine source or whatever it is. And they'll do it so much faster than me. And we can all retire, you know, go live on a mountaintop in New Mexico somewhere or something. With viruses going around, we may be doing this by phone. Who knows what's going on? You know, it's like, hello, coronavirus. Like, what the heck? You know, okay. So more phone therapy. Other questions? Things going on? Comments? What time are we? I have no idea what time we are. We're zipping along here. Everybody's doing well? Yes?
Well, one thing, you know, I'll talk if nobody else will. I never give up on that. One thing you mentioned a lot is anxiety and panic attacks. Uh-huh. And I've had a lot of clients with those recently. And what has seemed to help is helping them break down and say anxiety and panic attacks are like, it depends on the client as to how you phrase this, but to me, it's like a whirlwind or a tornado of all the basic feelings and emotions. And so if we can break those down and say, is it fear? Is it anger? Is it shame? Is it sadness? If we can give that anxiety and that panic attack a name, they can heal it a whole lot easier.
Yeah, I think by the time people are often having panic attacks, it's an accumulation of emotions and it can be overwhelmed. But it's the same thing. Is there one feeling that stands out, or what's coming up for you? Or when you feel it, where do you feel anxious? And it's interesting, because even with addictions like smoking, when you say, when you feel like smoking, where do you feel that? My throat, you know, my sinuses, my head. They'll give you different site locations, and it ties to memory or transition periods. Often addictions get tied or bound to the body during a transition period. And then when they go through another transition, they go back to that food or substance based on the original occurrence. So with addictions, particularly substance use disorders, which we call it nowadays rather than addictions, substance use disorders is our technical term. So with substance use disorders, we often want to ask, when they felt the need to use that substance, where do you feel that in your body? Where does that come up? But it could be anxiety, could be fear. The drugs people use often will tell you what emotion is coming up. If it's anxiety and fear, it's stomach. If it's anxiety in the chest, they're smoking. They're smoking pot or cigarettes, probably, or they're vaping. Maybe you got vaping things now going, right? It could be, sinuses? I don't know if there's anything specific for sinuses. A lot of anger and sadness is in the face, sinus area. It could be sugar. It could be food that medicates the mouth, the food area, you know, this area of the body. Chest, I think smoking was a lot about the smoking issue. Then a lot of memory in the stomach. We have a lot of people with digestive issues. There's rarely a client that I work with where they don't have something going on in their digestive tract. But your early childhood anxiety, you know, that being now the second brain, the stomach lining stores a lot of anxiety memory. I mean, when parents are fighting and they're upset, you know, that's the whole food thing. That was the whole marijuana thing for the teenagers. When the parents, domestic violence, they went, of course they went to marijuana. It medicates the lining of the stomach and increases appetite. So they're not nauseated anymore. It takes away the nausea, fear from the fighting. Even gives them the munchies, creates an appetite, and it takes away the anxiety. So the two main sites, it's definitely affecting the brain with creating a reducing alpha theta access to memory, and it's calming the stomach and reducing the anxiety and tension in the stomach from the domestic violence. So often when there's a marijuana dependency issue, I'm going to look for violence in the childhood history. A lot of quarreling, fighting, bullying, something, siblings teasing them, something that's creating a lot of distress and anxiety in the stomach. And last, did you have a lot of stomach problems as a child? Oh, yes. So their use of substances can hint at the prehistory, which sets it up and warns you in advance. So, and even the foods people use will give you a clue about that, about what they're medicating and why they're medicating. I refer a lot of people with food issues to the eating right for your type stuff, to for the blood types. Check what is your blood type. You know, some of that is nutrition. So I think our ultimate, you know, our treatment center that we want to design ultimately is going to have, you know, the QEG is going to have an excellent informed nutritionist who is aware of the HMR, integrates HMR into the nutrition plan. Those of you that are doing the coaching, you're in a perfect position as a personal health and wellness coaching. I have some people I met this week, one in Montreal, excited about training her. She has a whole network, but she has not done HMR, but she went through the whole narcissism thing with the parents and abuse and trauma from the sibling and all this kind of stuff, and has her own network and is amazing. And she's like, I totally get it. And she saw colors and saw the indigo violet the minute I touched her. I'm like, okay, you're probably supposed to be training in this technique. You're actually seeing the frequency of the technique immediately. And I said, you're very good at this. And she was amazed and did incredible work with it. And we'll probably be at our Canadian healing intensive. We're doing one in Sarnia, by the way, Canadian. So Meyer, hello, everybody. We're doing a healing intensive in Sarnia in June. So I think it's on the website already. So Gail Ferlin is going to help facilitate, coordinate the location there. So if you know Canadians that want to come in to do that part, we will be in Sarnia in June doing a healing intensive. So we did the training level 1-2 in Toronto. So Gail asked if we could bring it down to Sarnia, maybe pull from the States and from Canada, you know, but we will do a healing intensive for at least 12 in Sarnia at the Holiday Inn Express. Actually, it's in like Port Victoria. They have another name for it or something else, but it's next to Sarnia and it's right there. And so we will be doing that. I'm also doing a couple of intensive client sessions. I think the first one's already booked up in New Hampshire. So I am in, I'm near Boston. I'm in Waltham, Massachusetts 3 times this year. So we are getting some East Coast presence. I'll probably do some kind of a training. I'm looking at a different kind of training, more generic training, not necessarily a formal training for HMR, but like for your everyday person to learn level 1 and 2 and to see the technique and how to apply it in your daily life. So it's going to be like a different kind of 3-day workshop, like basics for your trauma resolution for your everyday, you know, parent, educator, how to take care of yourself for self-care. And it will be unlimited in size. We will be able to do larger numbers. And I suspect I already have 30 people signed up, filled up for my 5 days in April. And they think I already need an overflow in June. And then we'll probably do August for some kind of a training workshop near Boston as well. It's only about 45 minutes from my old Concord, New Hampshire location, actually. So I'm going to try to do a reunion with all my Concord people that I trained out there way back when. So I'm making some calls and trying to set that up. So it'd be nice to reconnect with the East Coast up there. So that's going. Now our Maui workshop got changed. The venue was not complete for us to do the workshop. So Maui this month, February, is moving to September. So Scott, I think Beverly already contacted you, Scott. And those of you that were in Maui, so we're moving the Maui workshop, and they asked, because some of them are therapists and they don't want to reveal their personal histories in front of each other in a traditional intensive.
Right.
What we're looking at possibly doing is a 3-day workshop that is like an intensive. It's kind of like an additional review of level 2 with new information, and an intensive based on whoever volunteers to work in front of the group can do that. And it will count as the healing intensive, and it will still work, but not everybody in the group would be obligated to necessarily do the work. But those of you that are strong, you've done your, some of your healing work, probably would have no problem with that. And that's what I'm thinking, is that we'll still do the equivalent of a healing intensive, but not everybody would have to do their memories in front of the group. Although I don't think they realize that you're in control of the process and that you only work on memories you choose to work on in front of the group. You're fully conscious in the technique. So it's not like we're going to force you to reveal anything. Although occasionally something can come up that you had forgotten about that would just surface in a group process. But because the group was pretty big, some of you were there, you know, in Maui. So, you know, Julie was there. You were there, Julie.
Brent, I never received anything about it changing.
Oh, we just had to, oh, okay, yeah. So the
no
Maui,
emails or anything.
You didn't get any information about
nothing.
That? Were you planning to go to the Maui workshop?
Yeah, I was.
You have tickets and all that kind of stuff?
No, No.
Okay, so that just got, what happened is I found out just the past 2 weeks that the venue wasn't complete.
Okay.
So the place where we were going to have it, we can't have it.
Okay.
And so they didn't really offer their house again for that location.
That's fine.
Which is fine, yeah. So I'm like, okay, well, then let's, and they were like, oh, we're kind of scattered. So one thing they did is they opened it up, though, again, like you came from the mainland. So they're like, oh, yeah, so people from the mainland can come again because they were going to keep it as a closed group. So, again, you're welcome to come to Maui. And same thing, Scott, you can either come to Tucson or you can go to Maui in September for the healing intensive. And that's a lot, you know. And it will be done by then, I'm pretty sure.
When's Tucson?
Tucson, we're moving the Tucson intensive from, let me look at my calendar right here. And we're moving it to October 5th through 7th, the healing intensive.
Hey, Brent, I already got my plane tickets booked for September.
okay. Well, like I said, we'll discount you something off the ticket to compensate for your whatever discomfort for this.
Okay.
It's not your fault.
So, okay. Yeah,
we'll knock the ticket value or something off your fee or just waive the fee or something because we already moved you once. So, you know, unfortunately,
okay.
Yeah, I think you're our only casualty for this one. But unfortunately, well, you could also, if you want to extend your ticket and go to Maui instead, you're welcome to do that and turn it into a tax deductible Maui vacation. You know, that would be nice. But
okay, well, I'll sleep on it and figure out if I'd rather go to Maui and decide which one would be best.
Okay, yeah, because that's fine either way. So you can either do Maui is the 21st through the, let's see, Maui. No, the Maui is going to be the 17th, 18th, 19th. And I probably, they asked me to consider doing a crystal healing workshop on Sunday the 20th. So we might play on the last day and do crystals on the 20th. So the Maui would be the 17th through the 20th. And then of September. And then Tucson is going to be the 5th, 6th, 7th of October.
Tucson. Okay.
Yeah, so either one. So we'll assist you in whatever way we can with that. So. All right. That's the only date changes to our schedule this year. Unfortunately, I was like, oh no, the venue's not done. We can't have a workshop if there's no venue. So
should we just check the website or expect updates?
Yeah. Jeanette's putting that up. She was waiting for me to just confirm the dates. And I'm waiting for Maui to give me absolute confirmation that those dates are okay. And some barring a volcanic eruption or something, you know, that's what we're planning for. Those are the
right.
Dates. Are
thank you.
And they told me I could pick whatever I wanted, but some therapists may be able to come. I mean, we're giving them enough advance notice this time that they should be able to rearrange their schedules. And those that were nervous about revealing their personal memories in front of the therapy groups, I'm like, you know, like you don't have to, if you want to volunteer and do that, fine. If you don't and you want to observe, that's fine too. We just need more people trained there.
Thank you.
Yeah. They're still trying to connect me with Jeff Bezos and his mother. So we'll see if that happens there because they work, you know, they worked on Mr. Amazon. HMR. Mr. Jeff Bezos knows HMR. You knew that, right, folks? I can say that because it's published in Celebrity Therapy Magazine. Or
that's interesting.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, be nice if you made a donation to the charity. Wow. Could you drop $1 billion or so on us, you know, just to kind of get us going, you know? He made $14 billion, what was it, sometimes 2 weeks ago in like 25 minutes or something like that. I don't know. I think Amazon lives here anyway. They keep throwing things under my grate outside my door. They'll keep delivering things. I'm just picking on you. Amazon's going to take over the world. I might have to reframe that. So anyway, other questions, things going on for people, cases, exciting successes? Nope. All is well. I think we're almost at time anyway, hour and a half. You all are looking well, so I gather you've all stayed healthy during all of this. I had 5 weeks of bronchitis. I'm still kind of achy. It might have been pneumonia, but anyway. I didn't go to the doctor. What can I say? You know, I'm just going to heal it naturally. But I'm breathing. Everything is good. I'm sleeping better. If you have trouble sleeping at night, I'm doing a device called a Navage, N-A-V-A-G-E, the Navage device. It actually is a salt canister, and it runs water in one nostril and takes it out the other. So it flushes out your sinus. You barely feel it. It's nice. But you can add stinging nettles. So I do 20 drops of stinging nettles, 10 drops of capsaicin. It's the natural pepper. 5 drops of eucalyptus, which enhances breathing. So antonym behavior is like big vapor rubbing your nose. So okay, eucalyptus. And I add that and put the little salt canister. I threw in a little bit of Tibetan sea salt and then put the canister, shut it, and then it flushes in one nostril, out the other. And by the time I go to bed, I'm completely breathing free. Everything is clear. Doesn't stay that way during the night the whole time. But if you have trouble getting to sleep due to congestion or sinus stuff, this opens up your sinuses and it's you can come up with your own nasal formula to flush your sinuses out. It allows you to add whatever you want to the distilled water before you do it. So that's been a lifesaver. I'm sleeping better and I'm back in alpha theta in my sleep states, but the sinus is open. So that's good to know. I'm putting myself to sleep faster using color. So I encourage you to learn to use your color to knock yourself out and put yourself to sleep a little faster, a little easier using your color brainwaves. And even if I do that in a 20-minute nap, I'll go into alpha theta. I'll be dreaming in the 20 minutes that I knock myself out. I'll go
Can
into
REM. Can you say more about that, Brent?
Can you say more about how you're doing that?
Color, particularly like what colors do I need? Start breathing it through my body and kind of from head down and through sinuses. And when the right colors hit the right nerve center that's keeping you awake, it'll knock you out. So I do that at Miraval. If I have a 22-minute break, I can take about 60 seconds to knock myself out and about 60 seconds to come back out when the alarm goes off, and I'll be gone for 20 minutes. And while I'm asleep for the 20 minutes, I'm dreaming. Actually, I'm already in alpha theta.
I've had the same success with that. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's really, the color's really good, especially if you're kind of empathic, intuitive. It helps to have a couple of crystals around in your hands to kind of get your hands activated too. It can be helpful. I found some stuff at the gym show that is, I had one piece last year and then I raided them this year, but it's a golden mica with black tourmaline in it. It's a golden mica, it's silvery gold, it's beautiful. And mica sends energy back to a source and black tourmaline takes out the negativity. So it's a very protective stone. Should anybody wish you ill, it will send the energy back to the sender. So anyway, I bought a bunch of that. So some of you may be getting little pieces of it from me time again. So it's quite nice. And I came across this group from Brazil that has these very, I'm no longer going for traditional stones. They don't even know what it is. So I'm finding stones that are coming out of Brazilian mines that have like ripples, layers. It looks like a multi-dimensional layer inclusions of some sort. So I raided them for all the weird included stones this year. And picked up other stuff. So you get to Tucson sometime. I have a lot of weird stones for you to feel the vibrations of. A lot of interesting stuff going on. Some pretty cool things. Pretty interesting. The more empathic you become, the more you can pick up a vibration from things that they can assist you in staying clear. And so I'm going deeper with my clients into their trauma histories. To do that, you really do have to take better care of yourself. My borderline, I can talk to you at some point. I'm probably out of time, but I'll take a couple of minutes. I'm working with a borderline OCD client. Basically, it's complex PTSD from a mentally ill mother that induced a borderline type state, but she doesn't act like a borderline, but she has the emotional borderline features, and as she's triggered, she'll go straight to hopelessness, rage, despair, and then vent, but never on the person during the session. It's always a post-traumatic response after a confrontation. And then she goes into OCD, obsessing about what she should have said or done differently or think differently. Or is my couch damaged? Oh my God, my couch is damaged. I have to lift the pillows and see if the couch is damaged. I think the couch is damaged. And there's no evidence that the couch is damaged. But I discovered finally that the trauma started with the mentally ill mother when she was at the age of the imaginary child of imagination. So what happens is her mind goes into a fear state. There's no parent to protect her. She has no adult parent self that to show up. She's completely, instantly in the 95% terrorized, fearful. Oh my God, the couch has been damaged. Another thing was, oh my God, my nails are done and I touched a pendant and nail polish got on my pendant. The pendant is damaged. Another one was, I bent over. And whenever she bends over so she doesn't damage her, it's getting kind of personal, but doesn't damage her anatomy. She always covers her breasts and chest when she bends over so she doesn't stretch anything or sag later in life, except that something was happening and falling to the floor, and she had to use both hands to grab the oranges or whatever it was. She's like, oh my God, I bent over, and there's a possibility that I could have stretched my chest or something in a way that would leave me. And I said, this doesn't make sense. I said, because the reason you reached, he said, because I was about to fall and I could have hurt my shoulder. And I said, this is very interesting. I said, okay, so your obsession is still there in spite of the fact that you made a rational decision or you made an instant decision that protected you from getting seriously injured. I said, is that a legitimate? She says, I know that in my head. But the part that reacts instantly with terror, like, oh my God, I'm going to have a wrinkle. Oh my God, my pendant is damaged. Oh my God, the couch is damaged. I said, do you understand as a borderline personality, all the objects you're describing are extensions of yourself? That if the pendant is defective, suddenly I'm defective. Oh my God, I'm in a panic. So she takes damage to the pendant as personal. She takes damage to the couch as personal. She makes damage to her breasts or any part of her body as personal. She's on Synthroid. She was talking to a friend on the phone and realized she went 2 minutes past her Synthroid medication time. Like, oh, I didn't take my Synthroid medication when I'm supposed to. She went into a panic. And I'm like, you know that none of these things have actually happened. You're imagining, you're fabricating defectiveness stories around all four objects. And none of these are actually damaged or in any way injured. So I said, it looks to me like your trauma occurred at the age of the imaginary child. And what's the problem with an imaginary child around a terrorist mother? Anything could be triggered which will terrorize you, frighten you, make you panicked. What's supposed to happen? A parent is supposed to show up and calm you down and say, honey, that's just a fear. It's just a feeling. Nobody ever did that for her. So her borderline features are that a small thing can happen and it's liable to become lethal and it's going to be about you being defective. Because every time a small thing happened to her, her mother escalated it into being about her. And it'd be a complete disaster. So it became a boundary violation, borderline. So every little thing that happens about pendants, about mess, about medications, about timing, whatever, all this panic is tied to an external object that she identifies with. So it's really not about the object. It's if anything in my life becomes defective, I'm in a panic and I'm going to die. And that's a borderline type thinking. That's from severe border boundary damage. So finally, we separated that out, and I said, you realize what's happening here? I said, you see that this is the trigger mechanism. It's not about these objects. I said, you have thousands of things in your house. She said, I know. My whole day is like filled with what's going to happen next or what could be defective. I said, you know, it's not about the house. I said, with the borderline trauma from your mother, the smallest little thing. She turned, oh yeah, I know. I poured water on myself one day in my crib and she raged at me for an hour. I was trembling. I said, exactly. So what's happening is the smallest thing that goes defective in an object and you're in severe PTSD, a severe reaction, and you're taking it personally. So I said, what do we need to do? She says, you know, I did what you said. I started tapping. So I'm tapping, like, you know, and so if you're familiar with any of the energy psychology kind of techniques, she's starting to do it on herself. Just because, or in the past, just because I thought that I was, in the past, I thought that I was, and she'll say this negative thing, like one thing went wrong and I thought I would die. Now I know that I own the pendant. I can take Synthroid whenever I want to. I can open my arms and protect myself if I'm falling and be okay with that. So, I mean, she's beginning to start to reprogram in and become the observer and not identify with the experience. And she's making some progress with that. Until now, she's like, you're the only voice that can stop the cycle. So I represent her, the mother she never had, the parent she never had. And that's what therapists do until they can assume responsibility. But something she's stopping on her own now. And she's like, oh, okay, so it's not about the pain. I can calm this down. But the couch thing, she had a lot of trouble with the couch and a couple of other things that were happening. And she was not able to release that very easily. But she's made real progress with that, and she's kind of getting it. But she's learning. I said, you have no maternal observer. You have no adult self. So when the 95% for the borderlines get triggered, they become the terror. They become the child. And the object within the field at the time it occurs, they identify with. So it's not about the pen. It's like, oh no, anything. So the OCD part comes in if anything now starts to border on defective or less than ideal, she goes into a panic and the whole thing is triggered. And when that's triggered, she's like, I know better. I know better. I said, it's not your, what Bessel van der Kolk said in his book, it's not the 5% moral rational mind that's the issue here. The problem is the 95% terror. But you take a borderline child with severe PTSD, mentally ill mother, blamed her for her father's death, blamed her for everything, no boundaries. So the smallest trigger to a child that comes along is going to reinforce her defectiveness. And then she's in terror and there's no adult to protect because she never had a role model. So what's happening in therapy is that she's begun seeing how I do it to become using my voice and my thinking and the processing as creating the external role model. And she loves the reframing and so on. But the difficulty is she's had thousands of repetitions of the mentally ill mother saying she's defective. And we've only had Brent repeating this for, actually it's been a number of years now, I keep repeating it to her. So she is finally imprinting slowly, but she's like, now are you beginning to see what's happening here? I said, the problem isn't your mother. The problem is, there's no mother aspect, no observer. I said in business, she functioned perfectly, very professionally, lovely. But when your personal life, you have no observer. So I said, right now I have been your representative observer. But understand, if we can get your boundary intact and separate out, and that's where the tapping card has been like, okay, I can become the observer. So one thing we tried with her today is I'm the adult who owns the pendant. I'm the adult who owns the couch. I'm the one who owns and sets my schedule for my Synthroid. I'm the one who decided to, I don't have to protect my chest. If I'm falling and going to get hurt, I can change my choices right now and protect my body in a different way. And I own my body and its defenses. So what I'm trying to do is if I own it, she's separating from the object. She's detaching and becoming the observer. She's separating from it. So I said, ownership puts you in charge. The object is here and you're no longer the victim of this whole thing, what's going on. I said, you don't understand. You've internalized your mother's negative, blaming, shaming thinking. And that's why it's so powerful in your subconscious that the adult you has never shown up for yourself. She shows up for other people and she's aware of that, but she has not been able to do it for herself. Anyway, that's a little bit about complex PTSD combining with borderline type features, combining with an OCD cycle. She truly is OCD. I mean, she does have the obsessive process, but she doesn't have it. It's specific. It's interesting because it's only specific to PTSD related triggers. She does obsess. Once she starts the cycle, she gets panicked and I can hardly stop it. But what we made progress with is like, oh, okay, I can stop that. So taking ownership, when she's a business owner, she's in absolute control. It's very interesting. That's why I don't think she's a true OCD. I think it's OCD induced from the PTSD and the borderline damage. So it's quite interesting, fascinating working with her. And she's made progress. She says that the pendant thing, that I could stop. Some things I could stop. The thing with the couch, oh my God, I think I've damaged my couch. Things that are new that she hasn't thought of before. She'll go for days. And when she gets so stressed, cortisol levels rise, and she's so somatically sensitive, her hair starts falling out. She starts losing hair within 24 hours. She's very connected to her body. She also hasn't gained or lost a pound. So you need to write a diet manual for yourself. She hasn't gained or lost a pound significantly in over 20 years. She has like the perfect nutrition diet. I think she eats all the food groups every day though. So who knows, maybe there's an OCD advantage that comes in somewhere in this life, you know, who's to say, but she's, the problem is she's trying to stay in a very precise place and she can't age. If she ages, she freaks out. So we're working on that. I was like, no, don't you want to age like the rest of us and be part of humanity? She now, since I've been working with her, she had no friends when I met her and for years had no friends. She has 5 groups of friends now and is actually attending different kinds of 12-step meetings also, is making progress with that. So it's taken a long time though. This is a tough, tough case. And she cannot do traditional HMR reframing. She can't see how the world could be any different from the way her mother painted it. But the interesting part is I think where she's stuck is in the imaginary child in a state of terror. And where HMR works best is using the imaginative creative child. So I'm going to be working with that. I'll keep you posted on that piece, but it's a very interesting case. And I think the reason she can't do HMR is that the trauma occurred at the age of the imaginative child, imaginary child. And so what she imagines every day is things with the couch that are damaged and the pendant damaged, and it never occurred. She's actually doing a false kind of a pseudo HMR. You see what I'm saying? She's catastrophizing her imagination into what's horrible. And she's having trouble imagining that HMR could be used to imagine something wonderful and different and nice. So she's never been able to do traditional HMR. But finally, I was like, it looks like the way you're talking and your language is a young child in an imaginative state and is panicked, obsessed at 3 or 4. I said, what age did your mother yell at you, scream at you, and beat you when you spilled water on yourself? 3 or 4. I said, I think that's the originating memory. But if I try to say, can we create a new mom? I'm like, I have no idea what that would even look like. I have no idea. She said, you can be my mom. I'm like, whatever. You know, I can use you as my parent. I was like, okay, you can accept a male, but you can't accept a female. I have no idea what a nurturing female would ever even look like. So we're getting there, but I think we found at least that maybe the HMR block is from the fact that the trauma was most severe and threatening at the most formative age, which was the age of her imagination as a little child at 3 or 4, that the borderline damage and the PTSD damage occurred at the age at which it would have been nice if she had been able to be a very creative, imaginative child, and it did not occur. Anyway, something to think about. Yeah, I'm sure you're gonna see it in early developmental trauma in some of the clients you work with, that when that attachment and that connection can't take place, we're going to have to find another way to work with that. She actually had a daughter and she did a really good job raising her daughter. But I think the daughter figured something out, because since that time, the daughter has disowned her. The only child is disconnected. So she knew that even though she was good with her, that the mother had serious issues. Anyway, that's a case for review, something to think about. But we can work with it over time. I'm still optimistic that we can use the imagination. I said, you're using imagination negatively to imagine catastrophic things. Can't we use it to imagine positive things too? So we're getting there slowly but surely. All right, everyone. Thanks for coming today. Thanks. Any other questions before we close? So Scott, if you want to hang out for a second, Jeanette and I will talk with you about the software and glitches that you're coming across. We are coming up with, I've been working with Jeanette to come up with the trainees version of the software. So if you've been with me this long, there's a good chance we could give you some months of access to it to start using the software, after which time you decide if you want to use the software in your practice or not. So probably 6 months free usage, and then after that decide what you want to do with it. Okay?
Okay. I've actually been using it for at least a couple months already.
Good, good, cool. And it's working for you pretty well?
It's working, although this past month, a couple days, it kept erasing my note, and so luckily I had written it down and was able to go back, or I learned to just copy the note before I moved on in case it wiped it out. But
Scott,
that might
on,
be
hang
related.
On, hang on 1 second. Jeanette, are you there with us still?
I am.
Okay. I just didn't see your happy face. I just said a big J. Okay.
That's because that's what I am, is a big J. Here I am.
All right, Scott. Anyway, continue. Sorry, I just want to make sure you do that.
Yeah. So the main problem that I had was that it kept throwing me out of the note back to the start, and it would wipe out the note even when I was saving it. But that only happened a couple different days. It actually the last time it happened, I think, was on January 30th. I don't know if you were still having problems on January 30th, and then it happened. It happened about a month earlier than that, where it did it a few times. But then that was about the time that I got the email stating that you were having a lot of problems with the software. You know that it had, that somebody had gotten into it.
Mm-hmm. By the 30th, we would have been out of it. By the 30th, we would have been out of it. So this may be a bug as opposed to...
Yeah, it might
to
be something
related.
Else. Well, the interesting part is it hadn't done that for me. So my
really?
My notes, yeah, I haven't had any trouble with session notes or nothing's been deleted. If I don't hit save at the bottom of the page before I switch screens, it will delete whatever's on that screen. It would be nice if there was a mechanism that when we switch screens, it saves the data automatically with screen switching. But I don't know if that's even possible.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, well, we need to do that and put that on all the screens that when you switch screens, your data save automatically. Because I forget sometimes and I'll take a whole history and then like, oh, let's bring up your master on your memories. And if I forget to hit save for the history, it's gone. It's just gone.
Are you guys talking when you move from the main screen where you do metaphors and all that stuff, like into the parenting exercise and any time off of that screen, you want to do a save of what's on the screen?
If you haven't saved the history, when you switch, thanks Julie, when you switch to, yeah, let's see. There must be a send thing here. I was going to send you a message, Julie, and I don't see that. Okay. Anyway. So.
Well, I was talking about the first screen that's got the narrative note and then the therapist's comments.
Notes,
or
right.
Okay.
Yeah, that.
I said the
that
session, Nellie, Scott, there are three things. There's the history section, and that's where I was losing it sometimes. And there's session notes, and same thing. For history or session notes or any of those three screens, if you don't hit save before you switch screens, it's going to delete whatever's on it when you switch screens.
Right.
So, Scott, this is Jeanette. Let me ask you a couple of sequencing questions. When you first come into the software, you come in and you log in, and then you can choose a client, then you can choose a session. Are you talking about the screen that occurs right after that, which is where you can put in notes? Okay. That's the one I need.
The narrative note and the
in-between screen. Is that the little in-between screen?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. That one's always been kind of funky. Yeah, we have to
I can tell you, Scott, that is on my list. I know of some known bugs in it. That is part of
Scott, let me say this. Don't use that middle screen, that little screen. Go to the main page, and then once you're on the main page, go to either history or session notes or therapist notes. That's up at your right-hand corner of the main screen, you know? If you use if you use those and hit save, it'll always be there.
Okay, so you're talking about the notes that are up in the right-hand corner, six pages.
Correct.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. So go to notes.
Go to those. Always work from there. I don't work from that middle screen. The only time that little middle screen has been helpful is if you need to go in and enter notes that you had not entered for a client on a given day, That little middle screen is the one that has the date that can be changed. That little middle screen that comes up will say date of session, location of session. You can enter that and actually create a note for a day that you had not entered a session for, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah.
That's the little screen. The only time it's useful, I've always had trouble. I even wondered why I put that in the software originally. But that's the screen you'd have to use to enter a session. Like if you want to go back and enter an old session note or where it located, where it occurred, that's the screen where you would enter that. But always, I always enter all the other data from the main memory screen. And so once that's there, you have the six little icons that come up on the right. So there you can do history, hit save, session notes, hit save. It would be nice if, Jeanette, we could put in the automatic save with just changing screens, because a therapist, like I haven't used session notes or therapist, I use session notes today. The client I work with mostly session notes because I don't do a lot of HMR with her. But there are times when Scott's probably entering like therapist notes. He wants to make a note about something or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, So anyway, you want to hit save at the bottom of those pages and it will be there.
Yeah, I primarily have been using that next page. You're calling it the middle screen, which is session notes, and I write out, you know, just briefly. I don't go into great detail, but I write out each incident, each trauma that comes up, and the amount, the somatic number on it, you know, like the rating. It's a 7. For tension in the neck or whatever. And I know that the last page has the option to do that. But when I'm writing the note, it seems easier to just let it be very, very complete, although I do keep it brief. The problem that I have on your first page, that where you pick the client and then it says session number, is there's some problems there, because when I hit the client and it says session number, it always comes up session number one, and the only way that I can figure out what session is, I've got to go back and open up the, you know, and count the number of sessions. That's not going to work eventually if I've done 20, 30 sessions with a client that I got to go back and count the number of sessions or well, I guess I would have to hit the last one and go into it and see what session number is. It would be a lot easier if that number could track itself, so that if I'm doing the seventh entry of note, you know, the seventh session, that it automatically would know enough to put 7 rather than me have to figure it out, have to track it down, you know, to make that an automatic thing would be good. The other thing is that
not doing it by date. You're not figuring the session by date. Because if you go to the main screen, you hit the date, and then like I'll see clients for 2 sessions on the same day. So what I do to get the notes is I go to the main screen, hit, and you can pull up any previous sessions, obviously. So you go to the main screen, hit the day, is it session number 1 or session number 2? But you're right, it's not numbering the number of sessions that you've done. That's true. It's not sequencing them.
Right, but the screen is asking you what session, and it's giving you session 1. And I think I had a problem a few weeks ago that I tried to put in a new number, and the number wasn't quite right, and it wouldn't let me proceed. So unless that was the time that you were having problems with the software, I'm not sure. But I do remember one session that I couldn't get it to go anywhere, because I had already done 3 or 4 sessions with a client. Session 1 came up, and I had to bypass it and trick it and call it like session 6 or something, just to get past it to get a session done. So it probably was my 4th or 5th session. I called it number 6 just to bypass it.
And the previous week I had had a problem where I started to put it in. I put in the wrong date and it was called session number two and I couldn't erase it. So then every other session, like that session had to be session three, even though it was actually session two, because I couldn't erase it. I couldn't delete it from the screen. So it's still permanently in there. You know, I didn't do a session. I just in error put a date in there by mistake. So that whole session number thing can get confusing, and it can also block. It has blocked me from progressing if I don't do it right. You know, unless that was when, you know, the problems were happening. I don't know.
Scott, this is Jeanette. Let me ask you a question. Do I have your permission? I can actually look on the back end of the software to look at the records that are being created. Do I have your permission to go look at your records and see if I can identify what might have happened in those things? I don't look at your client. I don't look at your client's info. I'm looking at records.
She, as the system administrator, has HIPAA access and has permission to monitor and make sure our records are done securely.
Sure.
But it's nice that she's asking you. Yeah.
So I can go actually look at what the software was doing as it attempted to record those sessions and see if I can identify what might have happened there. And if it was a bug in the software or us not explaining something correctly about using the software, that's what I'd like to identify. Because if it's a bug, I want to get the software, a software developer to work on it. If it's that I haven't communicated correctly how to use it, then I need to improve the instructions. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It does seem to need a little bit of change to help the therapist to get to the number quicker and to almost tell me what session it is instead of me having to figure it out, you know.
That's a fairly easy fix, Brent. Well, yeah, I think what he's identifying is that, let's say that he goes into a client, it's today's date, what he'd like the session number to do is default to the next session number. In other words, the software would go and look at the last session for this client and then add one to it, and it would present that that's what that session number is going to be. Uh-huh. And that's not a difficult fix when we get ready to do some of these updates. I can put that on the list to ask them to look at it.
Okay.
You know, so by default, rather than having
to go through it. One thing we may want to do, so I can get clear about what he's doing, because there's some things I've learned to do that I just do automatically that bypasses some of those blocks. But we might want to do like a little powwow where you let me take over the session, demonstrate what I'm doing. Scott can see how I do it. We could actually, Jeanette has a way, you can pull us all in to watch the same screen.
Yep, right? I can.
Yeah, so see, Scott, we could have like a little tutorial thing and see what's going on, what you're doing, what I'm doing, how we do it a little, maybe what's happening a little differently and why you're get, where you're getting stuck. It is true that if you want to go back and find out, like if I want to go back and find a client on a certain date, there's no way to do that in this system. You actually have to have the name of your client beforehand. If you want to say, now what client was it that I saw that had this problem on this date? There's no way for me to search the system right now for clients I saw on a certain day.
Right.
And that could be an issue. Like, what was the name of that client? Who was that back then that had this issue? You know, so that's a couple of things we want to look at. Eventually being able to do a search for a date, like pull up all the clients I saw on a certain day. That's something we want to add eventually. Because otherwise, if you don't remember your client's name, I have now 3,000 clients in the day. I just throw up my hands like, there's no way I'll ever find out who that was. I'll never know them. There's no way to check that. If I have the record from Miraval in the software and say, what clients did I see on that day? But you have to have your own personal list of the clients you saw on a given day and be able to find that name, or at least the clients that day, to figure out which client it was that had that issue. There's no way to go back and do that. So
there's no reason why we can't have that feature. I can tell you that's not a hard feature to deliver. The other reason why, Scott, that I really would like to do what Brent is suggesting is not only for him, you to watch him, but I'd like to watch a new user use the software, because Brent has had his hands so deep into the software for so many years. After a while, you learn the way around the little quirks. It's the new user that's going to run into those quirks and say, why does this work this way? And so someone like you showing us what you encounter as you're using the software may actually present either a bug or, a lack of proper documentation or whatever. And I'd enjoy that feedback watching you use the software so I can see what you run into as far as issues. Does that, am I making sense what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, of course. Absolutely. And I certainly would like to watch Brent do it on a screen and to try to, and to do a sample case myself and to put stuff in there so the two of you can watch the way that I do it, because it's not very smooth for me, although I'm not that electronic, you know, I mean, I'm not that computer savvy, but I'm getting it. I haven't had a lot of clients yet, so I don't have a lot of experience with it. It's not second nature. It is getting easier. Another problem that I'm having with it is on the session notes where that box comes up and it's got the one line that excuse me, that then starts to expand as the note expands. If I need to go back in there, it's very tight. So it's almost like it's squeezed. And so the top line or the bottom line might be half missing. And if I need to continue beyond that bottom line, I've got to put my cursor in there and then hit the arrow to get it down below that line to keep typing. It's not very, it's not very
responsive. The box content has not been user friendly. Yeah, it's true. It's very restrictive. It only gives you boxes that are so big you can type so much in, and then the screen starts disappearing. So it's not been full screen access to fill in your notes. Yeah.
Yeah. In the session note section, that's where you guys are talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Okay.
Yeah.
It's very limited. Right. That's always been an issue. So yeah.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. I mean, the session notes to have it separate like that, I don't think it's bad. It just seems very, very constrictive, and I work around it. But a lot of times, if I go back and add to that note, then again, I got to put that cursor in there. I got to try to get to the first line if I want to put something prior to the. To the first line, or to add on to it, I got to go down to the bottom, go past that back one with arrows or, you know, something. And it isn't the worst thing in the world.
It's not very word friendly though. It's not very editing friendly. No, I bet you. So we'll look at that. We'll have to look at all that. We're going to bring this to probably another software developer. Are you still inclined that we should go here to Tucson, Jeanette?
Absolutely. I'd like you to meet with the guy to see how you feel.
So basically the guy, Steven or whatever his name is in Baton Rouge, he's not equipped to deal with this kind of thing, right?
The answer to your question is that there is not a response out of Baton Rouge. So I'm going to assume by their lack of response that they are indicating that they're either
not
equipped to
handle. You're not talking about the host server host. You're talking about Trinsic, right?
I'm just talking about the software right now. Now, the people that I'm sending you to in Tucson are a full stop shop. In other words, they'll handle the whole nine yards.
That's fine. I'm just saying the guy who's currently hosting it didn't want our business, can't really fix this, can't do this for us.
He can't do software development. He's strictly a server hoster.
Okay. That's what I needed to know.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay. So, Scott, let's plan a time when we can get together in the next few weeks and next few days even for whenever Jeanette's available.
Okay, sure.
Or we could just kind of go over this kind of stuff and see what's going on, maybe ease it a little bit. So that would be good.
Okay, and
Julie had a question for me. Julie, you had a scheduling question?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I jumped back in. I hope that was okay for you folks.
Yeah, just for one second, sure.
Yeah, so I want to check in. When I went on the website and I looked up the May 25th to 27th Tucson, right. It actually takes me only to the February link.
I haven't fixed it.
Okay, great. Okay, great.
I just made a change about an hour before the conference. Check tomorrow. There's another page coming up.
Oh, no problem. Go. I'm just trying to check.
You asked the right question at the right time. Jeanette's right there to answer your question.
Yeah, Jeanette, is there going to be a May session as well as a September session then in Tucson?
Oh, no, wait. Hold on. I can answer that question for you. So you're looking at, so there is a May healing intensive from the 25th yes. to the 27th in Tucson.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And is there another one then in, that's cell level healing. Okay. Great.
What are you asking about?
I'm looking to see, because Tucson's closer to me than Maui, and it's possible that's going to be an easier trip for me to make.
Tucson, yeah. So we have a intensive in Tucson in May. We have a training in July, mm-hmm. and we have the next healing intensive will be in Tucson in October.
Excellent. Thank you so much, folks. And Scott, thanks for letting me pop in. Bye, folks.
No problem.
See you next month. Okay. Thanks so much for everything, Brent. Okay. Fabulous. Sure.
Thank you. Keep up the good work. Yay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's a pleasure.
Okay. And so Scott, yeah, so we need to just find a time we can kind of play with this and see what's going on. That'll give us a better handle what to approach the Tucson people with too. Then Jeanette will have to fly in. We'll all meet with the Tucson person. See.
You're going to fly Scott to Tucson?
No, I'm going to fly you to Tucson. Scott can drive to Tucson. I think. Well, Scott can fly too, I guess.
Well, then I'll have to fly to Tucson. If y'all want to do it in person, I'm going to have to come there.
Well, I think, Scott, you'd be a good person actually to kind of tweak it and like while we're getting this stuff straightened out with our software guy, say what you need, what would be best to have done, and see if it's going to bankrupt me or not. You know, I'm just kidding. But, you know, see how much it's going to cost and what it looks like. So.
So are you saying you'd like me to come to Tucson to be in that meeting?
For right now, I think I can meet with him initially, but we can actually do this online and kind of look at what's happening. Because I don't want Jeanette needs to see it and see what's happening because she might need to.
Sure.
In the past, Jeanette has had to be my translator with computer persons because I speak therapeutic. And she speaks computer IT logic and system server logic. And then the computer people speak other kinds of weird ASCII or some kind of crazy languages that they do their thing with. And so we're all speaking different languages and we like to all be on the same page. And you speak HIPAA, which is good. So it's nice that you're HIPAA informed. So you speak HIPAA, I speak some HIPAA and some computer, and Jeanette covers all these languages. So we're trying to, you know, the fact that we got the software done in the first place, I think is a miracle. People look at it and said, Did you do this? I said, I sort of structured and designed it and explained it to computer geeks and people in Jeanette, and then she translated, and then they did it, and then we're still working on it. So it's still evolving, but nobody's ever seen anything like this. I mean, there's just never been a memory sequencing software like this that's ever occurred. So anyway, we're working.
But I really would welcome Scott sitting over your shoulder on the, we can do this online. You don't have to go to Tucson. I would really welcome sitting over your shoulder and watching you work because I'm not supposed to use the B word, the break word, but I really and honestly mean it when I say that the best testing is someone who can actually find out this doesn't work, you know, and then I can determine, like I said, is it actually the software doesn't work or have we written the training manual in such a way the person can't use the software? You know, and it's always helpful to have someone who's just learning it or just starting out to show us that. So yeah. I'd really appreciate sitting over your shoulder and watching you.
Yeah, cool.
All right, so you guys pick a time. I'm retired. Well, let me put it this way. I retired and then started another business, but, you know, I will be able to find a way.
Viruses are the name of the day. These are dog viruses, viruses. Now we got coronavirus, so look out. Anyway, Scott, when are you free? When are you available?
I'm free most of the time because I'm not that busy yet. I'm only doing a couple clients a week right now. Two, maybe three on a busy week because I haven't quite got it moving. So
gotcha.
You tell me when you're available, and the chances are pretty good I'm available.
Okay, hold on. Are you free, Jeanette? Are you free tomorrow?
That may be tomorrow and Friday. This through this Sunday is maybe the shortest when I'm not as free. If we could do it next week, it would be better. I've got a bunch. I've got training and things scheduled. I'm training some medical volunteers.
Okay.
Here shortly.
We can do, we should probably do, I just need to find out. So next week is an option. How do you look on Wednesday, Scott, next week?
Next Wednesday, I am wide open.
Me too.
And except for a dental cleaning at 8 a.m., which you all don't have to participate in, I am free after.
Thank you.
I am free after like 10 a.m. Tucson time. So would you like to do something maybe in the afternoon? Would that be good?
Works for me.
Yeah, whatever time you want to do it. I'm free all day. So and I got the same time zone anyway.
Oh, that's right. You're same as me. So what time would you like, Jeanette, on Wednesday, noon, afternoon? What would be good for you?
My hunch is that I am free just about all day. I like afternoon, which puts me, if it's 1 o'clock your time, it's 2 o'clock my time.
No, what time are you right now? What time are you now?
I am 8:11 right now.
Okay, so you are just an hour off. Okay, you're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, this is not daylight savings time,
okay,
remember?
Gotcha. Okay, so what time would you like? And Scott and I will accommodate. How's that?
Why don't you say 1 o'clock your time?
Okay.
Does that work for you guys?
Yeah, yep. It works for me.
Yeah, that's fine. And how do we contact? Are you going to set it up on computer and
send
me an email?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to send you a Zoom meeting notice.
Okay.
And then that way we'll log on. And once we're on, I'm able to actually because I'll create the meeting, I'm able to, you need to be on your computer, Scott, so that I can share to your computer. And Brent's the same way, and we'll just share screens back and forth so you guys can watch.
Okay.
All right?
Cool. Yes, and Brent, I need to ask you a question. I thought I heard you earlier when we started talking here about the software. Did you say that I can test it for 6 months at no charge?
That's what we gave the trainees. Yes, we did give the trainees that option. Now, that would mean you've been paying. Haven't you been paying?
Yes, I've been paying, which I didn't have a problem with. And I'm not trying to change that deal, but I thought I heard you earlier when we first started talking.
Why don't we do this then for your healing intensive, wherever you do it, you've already paid a deposit, right? So
I've paid the $250, but I also am going to lose my airplane fare, which is, I think it's $100 and something.
Okay. I can reimburse you for that or something like that. So, let's not charge you for the rest of the healing intensive. If you want to keep using the software, cause it's probably been 3-4 months now already, something like that. You can still keep accumulating your memories, doing what you're doing. We won't charge you the $250 for the rest of the healing intensive, and I'll reimburse you for the airline ticket. That would come to about $400. That's $650 times 5-6 months. That's about $400. You're coming in the same range here. So you know what I'm saying? Compensating you for what you're losing here. So.
Yeah, that sounds fine. And I wasn't trying to go back on the original agreement. I thought that's what I was hearing you say earlier. The sound wasn't that clear, but I thought that's what I was hearing. I just
Yeah, we set that up. I think you jumped the gun before we had set up the trainees version. We were setting that up at the time. Jeanette was kind of working with that. We had not set that up, and you were like, oh, I want to use software now. So you already signed up with Beverly before I had a chance to talk to you about that. So that's fine.
I also, Scott, to tell you the truth, until this evening, I thought you were a certified HMR practitioner. When you talk, I'm just going, oh, he's got to be certified. I went back out and checked when you said that, and I went, oh, my goodness, he hasn't been able to certify. But that happens a lot of times when I've got people like you who have a strong background in therapy.
Right, and they've been doing it forever, and like, yeah, and don't need really you don't even have to be certified to be doing it competently. But
that's true.
We need him certified, and I'd like to see you having done that. So that'd be
yeah.
Cool. Then you could be a supervisor for people too, especially with attachment disorder stuff and everything else. So and
the that'd be good.
Yeah, that would be good to have you as a supervisor eventually. So, but for now, we won't get ahead of ourselves. So yes, let's do that. So send an email me, whatever. We can talk when I talk to you this week. Let me know the amount of your airline ticket. I'll send you a check. We'll do like a refund sort of a thing. And
okay.
Yeah, and then you can just keep using the software, pay your monthly fee, whatever, but we'll compensate you for anything that you've lost on having done it that way.
Sure, sure. That'll be fine. Should I send the amount of the airline to Bev Meland rather than send it to you?
Send it to me. No, send it to me. I handle okay, the at stuff, so.
Abuna
at Comcast.net.
Okay, send to Abuna. Okay. And then the second half of that that training would be free, you're saying?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. I will do that.
And I'll let Beverly know. So
yeah. Yep. All right. And Jeanette, you'll send me some kind of an email and you sent me an email today, so you've already got my email set up. Okay.
You are in my list, Scott.
There you go.
Okay. All right.
I sent you an email address. If you've got issues with the software, to use that one. Unbeknownst to me, and that was one of those bugs. This is years ago. We put that email address in there, and it hasn't worked for years, and I forgot to take it off the disclaimer. So.
Oops. Okay.
Whoops.
Oh, there's the main question that I actually sent in, which started this whole thing, was that I have the version of my history on my website. Clients download it, they fill it out, they walk in with it already filled out, and I need to download it rather than to have to transcribe the whole thing. So how can I the other question, we don't have to talk about it right now. We could save it until next Wednesday, but how do I download any documents? Because I've also got my disclaimer that is a little different than what's on the HMR website. And I don't know how to sign any paperwork that comes up if I wanted to sign. So signing documents and downloading documents into the system are two very main things, especially the history, because if I get busy and I get backed up with 20, 30 clients of histories, you know, it's going to be a lot of a backlog to try to do all at once.
I can show you how to download.
Yeah, the database is already set up for that. We have that.
I can show you exactly how to, you can take it in as a file.
Yeah, scan it, store it as a PDF, right? And then it goes straight to a file and send it to. So we have that set up. That database is there. We just have to show you.
There's a definite way to do that.
Yeah. You should have your database already established. It's already under your name somewhere. I'm not sure where it's at, but we'll find it.
Okay.
Okay.
I will send
all right. Thank you.
Out.
Okay.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it.
Wednesday it is.
Okay. Okay.
I'll
thank
look
you.
Forward to your email. Thanks, Scott. All right.
Okay, bye.
Thanks, Jeanette. Thank you.
All right.
Guy's name that's calling me? What's his name? The Tucson computer dude?
Oh, his name is Jeff Weinman. I'm going to send him your contact information, and I will CC you on the email.
Give me my cell phone, yeah.
Okay, I will CC you on the email so you have the information. And what I basically told him is, We want to look at the software development side right now. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I think if he really does turn out to be someone in his company. Now, what he did tell me was, I don't have anybody currently available, like immediately to start working. I'm about 6 weeks out before I can start working a new piece of software because they're booked. He says, we're trying to hire another developer right now. I said, I don't think that's a problem. I said, what I really want is for Brent to have a in-person person that he can talk to, because I explained to him, I said, you're not the IT person on this. You're the big vision. You have the overall vision of what this is supposed to do. And you do it best imparting it in person as opposed to via an email and all that kind of stuff, which is true. People have to actually see you do this and understand the concept to be able to program it. That was the beauty of Jared. Jared could sit down with you and understand
right. Exactly
what your vision was. This guy sounds pretty good. You know, I was kind of impressed with him. So I figure you can go down, kind of see him, meet him, and if you don't get a good feeling, we'll go look for somebody else.
Okay.
You know? Sure. All right. I will send that to you. You should get it. I'm going to send it to him in the morning, so you should get an email.
Okay, good. Cool.
All right. Yeah, and
I think I have the day off tomorrow. Miraval doesn't have any clients, it looks like. For some reason, it's a miracle.
Yeah. I don't know whether he'll call you. I'm going to give him your cell, so I don't know when he's going to call you. You know, he and I played phone tag now for a week, and, you know, I couldn't get back with him until today. So,
okay.
See what happens.
Okay.
Sounds good. All right. Well, I'm going to go take something for my sinuses and go get some sleep.
Yeah, I saw you rubbing your head. Poor little baby.
It's okay.
I'll send you healing sinus energy.
I know, please. Yeah. It's okay. It's also just been, we've got issues in our nonprofit group. I think I'm insane to have started a nonprofit group with women.
I was just wondering about that. You know, you might have me fly in and do a little intensive. Intensive for the board, see, of your nonprofit. So you need to de-traumatize them. You know, people that rescue animals, that love animals, have been among the most abused people on the planet. They don't always trust people, but they get love for the animals. They try to get love from animals. But their borderline stuff is going to go right into your nonprofit.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure. And of course, I'm susceptible to a lot. It's interesting because we have had a huge major blow up of a person across the street from me who I really thought was a friend, and it turned very ugly. And part of it was my fault because I got tired of some behaviors in meetings, and I did my, hey, you know, just bright light, lay the facts out crap. And I got quite the reaction, and to the point where I literally got a not speak the truth about me and accuse me of a backdoor channel thing. And the rest of the group was kind of like, okay, you know, don't escalate this. She's just going to escalate more. And so basically for the past couple of weeks, I have been and right now, till we move into the new building, our actual care of the dogs is at her house. So I have been in this, and you'll love this statement coming out of me. Okay. I have been in this hostage situation.
Right.
And you know how I respond to those. So, not with me.
Lilith's blue light might have to step in and do something here.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I finally last night, I have been in such a bad place, so angry, so mad, because I don't do well with hostage stuff. My back history just does not respond well.
You're not good at being controlled and manipulated.
No, I'm not. And I don't like when I can't, the way I learned, you helped me learn to do it, was to set a healthy boundary that says you can't come across this. Well,
we don't want Miss Sinek living across the street from you.
Right. Exactly.
And
I've been telling people I wanted to do that in order for me to continue to do the work, because I'm supposed to be the clinical manager. And I've got this, don't say anything to her. You're just going to escalate her. And I'm like, okay, so finally last night I just said, okay, I'm going to try a little bit of HMR on this. What was interesting is it wasn't the littlest blue light. It was Rebel inside of me basically kind of stepped in and said, oh, no, I will fix this. I am going to lay down a wall. You know, it was amazing. You have no place. And she kept talking while we were having to have this discussion, this round discussion. And Rebel just had it. She just took and gagged her.
Wow.
I just gagged her and basically said, you are not going to continue to do this. You will not, you know. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go with this. Myself was sitting back there going, all right, let's see what this is all about. But I felt a little bit better today. I really struggle when I can't defend myself and when I can't lay down good, healthy boundaries.
no defense for mental illness or narcissists. They're going to do what they're going to do, and you won't change their mind sometimes. So. Oh, well, hang in there. Take care of you. Breathe color.
I am breathing. I'm right. Trying to get to the point where, because it's really interfering with the care of the dogs. And right. I mean, it's a whole long story. Sometime when we've got several drinks over a couple.
Or you might have to fly in and have me. You might need a visit to Tucson and be traumatized. Might need a
I basically, in an email out to them, told them that in the state I'm in, I'm not open to discussion, and that if it weren't for the fact we were at such a critical place in the development of PPRC, I would take myself out of this for a while until I could put my emotions back into place. And I got this, you can't do that, we need you to be here. And I'm thinking, y'all don't understand. I know me well enough to know when I am not in, when I am emotionally not on good, you know, when I'm not balanced and I need to go balance myself. And I told a couple of people who said that to me, I said, okay, I'm going to stay here. But what I'm going to have to ask of y'all is y'all give me some kind of, I will run things by you. You can give me advice as to when I should speak and when I should not. And I'll honor it for right now. But you need to understand I'm unwilling to engage in part of this right now because I can't do it in a constructive manner. And I don't believe in verbal destruction. I witnessed that enough in my life. So it's been an interesting journey. I hope at the end of this, I'm going to feel like I've grown.
Yeah, I think you will.
For sure. You know, that would be the positive out of this.
What doesn't kill us makes us stronger, right?
Right. And then, of course, the world and everybody I'm around is flipping out over what's going on in the world today.
Yeah, I know.
And I live in Texas where you're not supposed
to. Well, don't feel bad. I weeded out with a client last week and virtually threatened to not see her again if she kept voting for Trump.
seriously?
Yeah, I lost it. I'm like, this is just, if you keep pushing this and talking about this, I will not see her. And I've never said that to her. You're serious? I'm like, yeah, so we will never discuss politics again. I said, and then when I texted her, I said, she has a habit of saying that woman, she won't call her mother by her real name.
Uh-huh.
So I reversed it. I said, if we ever mention that man again, so I unnamed him. I unnamed him. I said, if we ever mention that man again, we get a problem. So let's not ever do that. I said, don't respond back to me. We're just not going to go there. Because they're like, wow. Oh, he's so wonderful. He's moving the capital of Israel to Jerusalem. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to throw up on her. Like, okay, can't do this. Can't go there. I said, he's destroying the environment. He's destroying the future. If he has, he'll be there another 4 years. I said, another 4 years. So I texted her. I said, you do realize I'm an empath. And all of the women and the men that married narcissists that are completely freaked out have been in my office for the last 3.5 years. And I said, I can't do this for another 4 years. Not like this. I said, I can't have that much crazy coming in. So I will reduce my private clientele. I reduce some travels. I will do some workshops, but I'm not going to be bombarded by the empathic state of the planet when there's a crazy man running around. Yeah. So I said, we take better care of ourselves. We choose our battles like you're doing. You choose your battles and they'll have to listen to you or we will pull out. I said, I've investigated dual citizenship. If I buy a house in Canada or Italy, and I establish residence, I said, I will be a dual citizen of two different countries. And I said, I could actually live somewhere else if I chose to do that.
Yeah.
But I'm seriously there yet. But, if he gets another 4 years, there's going to be issues. There's going to be a problem.
I don't know.
We may be building a great big old log cabin in New Mexico that's off the grid with a huge-ass telescope. And you would be welcome to come out and stay as often as long as you like.
You know when it's bad? When my husband is like, I am going to have to become a Democrat.
Oh, wow.
I mean, really. I said, no, honey, you want to be an independent like me? He says, you don't have any power with an independent. And I went, and of course, he is not a native American citizen. He chose to become, and he is so angry and so bitter. And I've talked to my son, and of course my son's in the military, and he's like, he's my commander in chief, Jeanette. And so Randy has a hard time saying negative things. Right, and it's right. like, I keep sometimes, you know, there isn't many times that I wish my mom was still alive, but I wish my mom that was the mom when I was in high school was still alive, because her ability to see history from a long point, you know, long range, I just think about what she would say about what this man has done, let alone emotionally to the world, to the energy of the world, but what he has done to the Constitution and to the things in our country that allow us to be and have the freedoms that we have is beyond scary to me.
I know. And another 4 years, he's escalating because he thinks he's reaching, might be reaching the end. But if he gets another 4 years of this after, if you give a narcissist a win like that with the impeachment thing, he now thinks he can get away with anything, and he's angry now. And he'll take 4 years of rage out on the country for the next 4 years of what they did to him. And it's going to be a shitstorm. So they've got to get him out, or somebody just needs to eliminate him from the picture, you know?
Oh, I still believe, and I've never been someone to want to go be politically active to try to get people to vote. But if there was ever a time, this may be it, because I don't care who it is. It just has to be a part. I actually believe two things have to happen. I think we have to clean the Senate, you know, and we have to, because there are rules that need to be put. Randy, my son, made a really good point. He said, Jeanette, this has been coming on for about 20 years now, where the Congress has been usurping its authority to the president. It's been going over to the executive branch. He said that our forefathers never envisioned or truly believed that we would see this. So when they wrote the Constitution and the laws, they thought there would be a gentleman's agreement. There would be respect of the two sides. He said, I think we're going to have to codify some laws that restrict presidential power down, because we've seen what happens when someone with no morals gets into the White House and gets a hold of that kind of power. They don't have the moral character, fortitude, maturity, whatever you want to call it, to know what to do with that kind of power.
They don't.
You know, so anyway, it's kind of wild. So, and I've got all of that going on around me too, and that in and of itself. I mean, I had the same reaction the night that he got elected. I sat outside because I couldn't stay inside, and I sat and I absolutely sobbed. I mean, not because Hillary had lost, because I wasn't a big Hillary fan.
No, we know what it meant. That's what was happening. It's like,
I was so afraid. Well, when the night that they refused to have witnesses, when the Senate did that, I had exactly the same reaction. All I could do was sit outside because I thought, I cannot even be indoors, even though my house.
And then he's trying to kill off and eliminate all the witnesses, like revenge, like a bad schoolboy, and he thinks he can get away with it, and he's getting away.
No.
And that's the scary part. Is like, it looks more like a dictatorship or something than you know, a democracy. So I hear you.
I agree, and it's a really interesting thing to watch, and it's so subtle. It's in your face now, but I mean, he's so.
Well, no, he doesn't ever do it directly himself. He always gets henchmen and other people to do the dirty work. So his fingers are not attached to the evil he does.
But you know what else? Mm-hmm. He is a master hypnotist.
Yeah.
I actually, it is, there's so.
Well, no, here's the thing. He doesn't have to be a master hypnotist. He just has to be the narcissistic, grandiose, deluded person that he is. And what happens is, when people are already in hypnosis and hypnotized by their traumas and the society, they get desperate enough to believe whatever somebody says to them.
That makes sense. Triggers
them. So he knows how. You're right. He knows how to masterfully trigger and manipulate populations that are uneducated, innocent, believe whatever he says, just want the control thing, the knowledge of big government to stop. And they don't realize they're turning all of their vulnerability over to the hands of a 2-year-old narcissist with no ethics, no ethical training, no morality. And they don't realize they're doing that. They think that, oh, it's a fresh break from traditional government. we don't realize traditional government had standards, had ethics, had boundaries, had like, oh no, it didn't work the way we want it to work. So we want, let's make America great again. Like, holy shit, you're about to flush it down the toilet.
Yeah.
You know, foreign relations are in the shitter. You know, it's like the whole thing is going down the tubes. And they have they're oblivious. They're uneducated. And the majority of people in the urban centers that are highly educated voted for Hillary. The popular vote was Hillary by several million votes.
Right.
You know, he didn't win the election. And I am convinced, you know, a friend of mine said he's in touch with several groups and said they did a forensic analysis of the voting records in Florida in those counties that he just managed to win mysteriously. Mm-hmm. And he said in all of the majority of the counties, he won by exactly the same percentage.
Yeah, he gamed the system.
Well, no, he said by you know, statistically, that's an impossibility. You can't even get like 1 in 4 billion or something like that.
Right.
Chances that could occur. He says clearly, and they found the guy who developed the program that went into the voting machines, and then also he developed a worm that would erase the record, erase the track.
Yeah.
So you couldn't see. And then right after the election, there was no forensic analysis of the voting machines. Nobody went to even look at it. And by the time they did, it had erased itself. So there was no way to track and find out. But it's impossible. He could not have won by the percentages, identical percentages in each of those counties. So what they're finding now is that all of these voting machines have access to the internet and they were hacked, basically. So he didn't win the election. The Russians won the election. So anyway, we know what happened now, and I knew it the minute it happened. I said, there's something greatly wrong with this. This isn't what actually just happened. It's what we're seeing, and the whole thing has been rigged. And the American government, and even if they found out about it, couldn't tell the American people this, because it would basically say, our government was handed over to the Russians for a period of time, and they won the election for him. And so, it would undermine all confidence in government. And if these
See, I have a theory that the other thing that he tapped into, and this sounds misogynistic. It isn't meant misogynistic. It's an energy as opposed to, but I call
it. So there is a fundamental prejudice.
Yeah. The white male, the white male energy. There has for many years been a pain in the white male energy of our country. This could be women or men, but it's this belief that America was ours, and there is a pain of realizing we're not the top. We may not be the top dog, and there is a fight to not let that happen. And what he did is he tapped into that, and he escalated it and he turned it into a weapon. And what I think a lot of those people don't realize is he has tapped into their pain and their fear that they are not going to be the top dog in this country anymore, that they're, you know, these other groups are going to take over. And so he stokes that, and they react.
Oh, yeah, the racism, the prejudice, he's tapped into.
Oh, yeah.
No question. I agree.
You know, so, and he takes them out. I mean, and because it's interesting, even people that I talk to that are pretty, if they have any openness at all to hear, if I actually sit and say, okay, they make some statement and I go, all right, let me do this. Cause I've heard that. And then when I went and tried to find the sources behind it, you know, and cause I always tell people what I'm looking for is the source. Can I go find a written document that documents the source? I had somebody say, what the good does that do? It's still fake news. And I went, no. If somebody writes it down, if they document it in writing, there you can trust that more than you can something said on TV or on the internet. And they said, why is that? I said, have you ever looked at the liability laws in this country? People, that's why newspapers and things like that are very careful to source what they begin to write, because they're liable laws they can get. I said, if we had those same liable laws for the internet and TV and all that kind of stuff, some of this would go away. And when I've gotten people and actually put them through the, hey, let's go look up the source, and we found out it was just something out on the internet, every now and then I've seen that little chink in the everything about type thing, and I've seen them kind of start to listen. But not too often. Sometimes they're very violent in their reaction because they don't want to have anybody tell them that anything he says cannot be possibly true.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, so, I can't believe it. The people that watch him all the time are like, oh, he's the best thing that ever happened to, like, oh my God, can people really be that deluded about that and not see it?
But they are. Yeah. They are. And they don't believe he's told 15,000 lies, even though somebody can line it up with facts. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen a reporter take a Trump, somebody that's trying to defend his policies, and say, okay, let's take the facts and literally take a statistical facts, put it in front of them, and that reporter, literally, that person or that op-ed, whatever you want, literally change the subject and not be willing to address. And when I've seen a reporter push them, and they've gone, I just don't go into that. And I'm like, I don't even know how people, highly intelligent people, defend that in their mind. I don't like to be proven wrong. None of us do. But my God, at some point you have to be honest with yourself. So anyway, that's also, I live in Texas, so I got a lot of that crap going on.
I got you.
So hopefully, hopefully Arizona will be one of the states that turns. I think there's a possibility for Arizona.
Well, we did turn, and then the what's-his-face died, and then the crazy Republican senator who lost the election was appointed by the Republican governor to replace
the
senator. Like, oh, what the fuck? We finally got
telling you, people are going to have to push. Well, there's going to have to be a cleaning in many, many places.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, honestly, boy, if you'd have told me 4 years ago, I thought it was time for us to have a little bit of Republican influence in our country. Because we need a little bit of the discipline that sometimes it used to be, the discipline that the financial discipline that the Republican Party tended to bring at times. I thought it's time for a little bit of, you know, let's draw government back in, let's consult, you know, that is not what happened. So, yeah. All right, I'm gonna let you go. It's been late and I'm tired. I need to go take some medicine.
Okay, love, get some rest. Hope you feel better. We'll talk on Wednesday.
All right. I'll send out a Zoom notice. Take care.
Sounds perfect. Bye. Thanks, sweetie. Okay, bye.